Supreme Commander, it's good to see you. A safe journey, I trust.
Nothing is safe anymore. You've heard, of course, that there have been 2 attempts on my life.
I have. I was very concerned.
I consider Blake to be responsible. Oh, not personally, of course. But stories of his exploits are still circulating. They excite people. The fact that he is still free gives them hope, and that is dangerous, Travis. Hope is very dangerous.
This is Bristol. It's World War III Week 3, Friday at 5 o'clock, and welcome to the Bristol Politics Show on the 20th of March, Friday the 20th of March 2026, streaming live from a corner of freedom called the Coomber Centre, close by Bristol City Centre, which is waging war on the poor here, trying to tax them all the time. And trying to squeeze council tax out of people with nothing constantly. So this is the way it is now with this world of council tax, which hopefully will be destroyed and abolished very soon. So don't believe a word we say. But we'll try to share some moments of clarity from Bristol's Templar Port. That is, it used to be a Templar Port here, turned merchant venturer fiefdom in the City of London's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com between 11 and 2:30 Central Time, 87.7 FM in West Sweden, Wisconsin, and maybe a little bit of a mix-up there, 1 hour one way or the other, in between the summertime and wintertime. And also live on the Bristol Politics Show app, available free from GitHub and Apple App Store. That is, the GitHub is the best go-to place for the Android version, and the Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. So that's the Bristol Politics Show app. Easiest link to find is either pinned on my Telegram channel, Tony Gosling Censored, or else it is on the show page of this week. org.uk. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the Talk Radio stream, except 5 p.m. Monday to Thursday, when we have the Richie Allen Show live. This week's special guests, well, there are several more, but the main ones: Nigel Day from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, talking about what's going on up at Fairford, the US base, saying it's a RAF base, but it's not really, as we're about to hear. So that's where the US bombers are heading off to Iran every day from. Lots of plane spotters loving it, but not everyone is loving it. And also we'll be hearing some analysis from the former editor of The Ecologist magazine for many years, and a geopolitical analyst too. We don't hear anywhere near enough from. That's Oliver Tickell. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its accelerationist zero trust agenda, bending our minds with Orwellian BBC Verify, or boring us to tears with vacuous celebrities, puff pieces on the conspirators, hatchet jobs on the heroes, Nick Land's Dark Enlightenment, social Darwinist control freaks want us as slaves to AI, or maybe just dead. Albert Pike's Zionist World War III plan is a big taboo. Meanwhile, the wife-murdering pantheist WEF king Tampon Charlie and his vampire queen Carmilla wage war on the British people, as well as China, Russia and the BRICS. Now, anyone who's not their mates. In fact, the Crown prosecutes us for praying for unborn children, and the only right they want us to have is a so-called right to kill ourselves with the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. So it's not the end of the world. Or is it? Some are certainly wondering about that, particularly the US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, helping us navigate the Fourth Reich in Bristol, Britain and around the world. It's Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
We were hearing from Matt Errett just after you left last week, if I can pick up on that. He talks about disposable Zionism. He's saying the idea is actually Zionism is going to be a catalyst to create wars and things like that. But actually, at the end of it, Zionism is going to be extinguished by all this.
Well, I mean, that's a speculation, isn't it? It's quite possible. A war like this, a big one, will lead to some states not existing at the end of it.
And about this whole idea of Zionism, everyone is being whipped up to get behind it, but maybe it's serving some other purpose.
Well, I think there's possible all sorts of possibilities of what the real power structure is, but the reality is what they're doing now is what they're doing. How it's going to play out and who's really pulling the strings at the end of the day and who's going to be left standing at the end of the day is actually open to question, isn't it?
So who do you think?
Well, I think the obvious point to make is that the Zionist billionaire tech lobby dominates both Israel, the United States, and, of course, little old Britain.
That's what about Europe?
Well, Europe as well. All the Western power structure is the Western power structure. It's imperialism. That's what they used to call it. You know, that's what Che Guevara would call it, or Lenin. It's Western imperialism. And it's been dominating the planet for 500 years. And then they're just about to lose that dominant position to the Chinese, and that's why we've got a world war.
And have we also maybe got a world war because the Epstein class is finding itself rather hemmed in? People like Mandelson, obviously Epstein himself is dead, and Ghislaine Maxwell, but going to trial?
Yes, I mean, obviously the whole purpose of all of that blackmail was to do what they're doing. And that's what, and they've done it. You know, they've got enough power to do that, so
more,
they're doing it.
News has come out this week about Peter Mandelson's role in procuring these government contracts. I mean, it does sound peculiar that he's over meeting with the bosses of Palantir as US ambassador, and he's having off the record, unminuted meetings with them, and then suddenly, a few weeks later, a big contract for half a billion pounds, £500 million, just under £500 million, by the way. Because if it was £500 million, it would have to go through extra scrutiny. And then this contract is signed just a few weeks after he has this unscripted, off-the-record meeting where there's no minutes kept.
Well, yes, I mean, that's the thing about Tony Blair. Tony Blair has made himself a multimillionaire on the back of all these kind of contracts that he's got with the Gulf States, with the Americans. He's on the board of peace. Mandelson's a mini-me for that, isn't he?
So this is just simply a way to funnel money from corporations that are, well, they're not even winning these contracts, they're stealing these contracts. And once they do steal the contracts, all that public money goes to Palantir and a whole percentage will be shoveled into Mandelson's pocket.
Yes, I mean, Mandelson is one of those who's on the take. There's plenty of other people with their snouts in the trough, isn't there?
You're trying to excuse Mandelson?
I'm not trying to excuse him.
Well, maybe that's why he wanted that job. Well, of course, so he could go.
Listen,
and
I mean, these people schmooze each other and they do each other favours. It's what happens.
I can imagine Mandelson over there going, well, I am the government. You know, this, of course, is what people want because they know the government has got an unlimited pot of money.
Well, that's right. So what you've got. If I would argue that if the government is spending money, the government should be doing whatever it is that they're spending the money on. Because if you give it to a private corporation, once they're embedded, like Oracle or any of these tech giants are embedded within the infrastructure, tech infrastructure, you can't get them out. Yeah, everything has to revolve around their
totally
particular software
on
and all
them,
the rest.
And let's remember Birmingham.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what
happened in Birmingham was, I mean, we're just worth going over that briefly. It was a contract, IT contract, that Birmingham City Council simply could not get out of. And they had to pile more and more money to try and sort it out, but it wasn't sorting it out, it was making things worse. So it was like a kind of debt trap, really, around their necks.
That's right. And, of course, there's other factors at work, which is the underfunding of local authorities like Birmingham. So that whatever they do, they're not going to have enough money. And, of course, various splits and problems with actual decision-making on the ground.
This is obviously good for corrupt individuals like Mandelson, and it's also good for the big corporations making this money out of the public purse. But are there people, do you think, in the public sector too that are just going along with it?
Well, what used to happen is that the civil servants who were public servants would say, well, we're not doing this, it's going to cost a fortune, and, you know, we need to do this in-house. But, of course, over the years, the government's capacity to do stuff in-house has just gone. They used to have their own people to do all of these things. Now they have to buy in somebody to do it because they don't know how to do it anymore.
Well, it's almost like it's. I feel like it's time to bring in Fine Print. That's Andy Roberts to do a report on Palantir contracts. But actually this week I noticed it's a Scouse Oracle that's been looking at this actually for several weeks now. And so let's have a listen to one of her reports on one of these Mandelson contracts that's been signed with the British government.
So instead of building common systems in-house, and like I've been saying before, departments are increasingly relying on external platforms that were already available, already approved, and already working somewhere else inside the government. So over time, procurement has stopped being a way to just buy software. It's literally become the mechanism through which core state infrastructure is being assembled piece by piece, department by department, and without ever being named. And this is how systems are moving from just being tools to becoming foundations. And as we know, once something becomes foundational, opting out stops being a real option. And being structured, and according to the notice, the platform is designed to integrate multiple data sets, bring structured and unstructured information into a single environment, identify patterns, automate analysis, and support officer-led decisions. And it matters because we know this isn't just admin software, it's decision infrastructure, it's workflows that are going to shape what gets noticed, what gets flagged, and what gets acted on. And I'm not saying that this is illegal when I say the 489,999, bear with me, this isn't any evidence of wrongdoing. I'm noticing a pattern. In practice, contracts at this level receive less external scrutiny than the larger ones, the larger term programmes, especially when they're framed as short-term pilots. So scrutiny in the public procurement isn't triggered. It's triggered by thresholds, scale and permanence.
Thresholds, scale and permanence. Well, the threshold here is 500 million, and they just in under that by just a few pence with this Palantir contract. It's not permanent, and it's a trial scheme. So the idea is, well, we're just going to do it. We don't really need much scrutiny. Let's shovel this money to Palantir.
Yeah, I mean, the health service unions, for example, are pretty clear that we don't want Palantir having access to NHS data, full stop.
So we had, yesterday, we had BBC Question Time. You know, it would be nice to see Fiona Bruce, or in fact anybody really, holding Wes Streeting's feet to the fire over the Palantir contracts at the National Health Service. Nobody does that, it doesn't seem. I think actually maybe it's possible that the Green Party woman did, in fact, do that. Caroline Lucas. Yeah, in fact, I think she did, didn't she, yesterday? Well, you know, there's very, very little of this going on. One of the most worrying things is Palantir's contracts to do trials with the Britain's FBI, I'm sure most people will know what I'm talking about here, but the National Crime Agency, that's the ones, and with individual police forces. Palantir are going in there saying this is just software to support your decisions. Well, do you really need it? And also, who else has access to it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a big power play by these people, because once they are embedded into all of these structures across the West, it'll be virtually impossible to get them out. It's like having, you know, terminal cancer.
Okay. So just for just before we get started on get our teeth stuck into the Third World War, which seems to be starting up in the Middle East and has been for the last 3 weeks, let's have a little zoom down here on planet Earth, because we're seeing such, it seems to me, amazing changes in the way planning works in our cities. So this is the decisions which determine what our cities are going to look like into the future, hundreds of years even into the future. One of the most controversial decisions, we've had Joe Banks on here several times over the last couple of years, detailing the serious corruption going on at Bristol City Council. I mean, deep corruption, as well as the purging of all decent planning officers. So if a planning officer says, hang on a minute, that doesn't really fit with the rules, they find something horrid happens and they lose their job. And the idea is that there's only pliable stooges were left in the planning system that go for people who've got maybe too many panes on their greenhouse or something, and yet these massive luxury and office buildings are towering up now into the skies around Bristol. And in fact, one of them, I think it's called the Boatyard on the Bath Road, the A4 heading to Bath, along the side of the River Avon, has actually been sliding into the River Avon because it was very badly positioned right next to, in fact on top of the bank of the river, which is all mud, and so that's had to be stopped. The company went bankrupt, and what I'm now hearing from people working on that is that they've got massive swimming pools, Martin, in between the floors. Water's accumulating, enormous. You know, if you can squeeze in between the gaps between one floor and another, you'll find there's a massive pool of water that's been collecting inside it.
Well, I didn't know that about that particular development.
I don't think they're even telling the people buying the properties there either.
No. I think what may happen if we go into a recession, depression, is that a lot of these speculative developments will simply stop.
The figures stop adding up, don't they? They're thinking, well, actually, we won't be able to get that for it, so let's not spend the money and let's not borrow it because we won't be able to pay it back. But then there's also, of course, there are people that will do this and then just say, oh, well, sorry, we went bankrupt, and the bank has to take a hit. But then, of course, the bank won't take a hit when it comes to you. But it will to with these con men corporations. Anyway, let's have a listen now to what's been going up at Bristol Zoo. For many, this is something which, as youngsters in the 1970s, you could watch Bristol Zoo every week on the BBC. BBC Bristol went live there and into the studios at BBC Bristol for a programme called Animal Magic with Johnny Morris. Bristol Zoo was the first. It was an amazing zoo, a nice little programme, you know, very good for kids. And the Bristol Zoo was taken over by this so-called trust, and the trust has then decided, well, actually, this land is worth much more as private luxury flats than it is as a zoo, and so they are in the process of settling. They've got rid of all of the animals now, moved them out the other side of the M5 onto a little plot of land over there, which they're making a big fuss about, but it doesn't look as if it's going to really go anywhere. And of course, you know, it's far much further for any of the school children to go to the school on visits, etc. You know, it's completely inaccessible for most Bristolians being so far away, but the point is that they're making money at it. And local residents have been at protest this week against this. The company doing the development is called Acorn, and hence you will be hearing them calling for Acorn to withdraw from this planning development. They want it to go back to being a zoo, please.
Acorn, withdraw! 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 Acorn!
We're hoping to achieve more public awareness. We hope the public can be made to realise that it's not over yet if they pile in behind us. Acorn still has to make this work. We're completely convinced that they're not going to come up with the money. They're not going to be able to complete the project. It's going to be fearsomely complicated. We're going to be on the case all the time. We're going to find every possible way of stopping them, slowing them down, and making it impossible for them. Bristol Zoological Society needs to wake up and realize they have a moral responsibility for these gardens, which have been looked after for them by the people of Bristol for 200 years. And that they should rethink the whole scheme of closing it and building over it with concrete and apartments.
Yeah, so it hasn't actually been built on yet. It is the oldest provincial zoo anywhere in the world. It is like 200 years it's been there. It has been there. But it seems that they may be coming a cropper, because what they've tried to do with this plot of land is to make the most money possible out of it. That is by building these really high-end private luxury flats on it.
Well, yes, I mean, that's what the story all over the city, isn't it? Bristol is just becoming a luxury flat place.
This is the most lucrative sort of property development, apparently. And many of the people buying flats there will be buying them as an investment. They possibly won't even live in Bristol or in Britain at all.
No, I mean, you've got these huge tower blocks down on the River Thames in London, and hardly anybody is registered to vote in them because they're all owned by foreigners, and they just, you know, they occasionally visit, and they just, you know, it's a way of saving, you know, banking your money. If you're a Colombian drug lord or a Saudi prince, that's what you do.
So what's your thoughts about, I mean, looking at in the context of Iran with the economy, are these sorts of luxury flats for the super rich, are they something which might weather the storm? Because the super rich tend to keep their money, don't they, in these sorts of circumstances?
Yeah, well, obviously the very wealthy will carry on spending money because they're the ones who've got the money to spend. So, you know, it's unlikely that they will, you know, not have nice places to live in. But on the other hand, you know, some of these developments just aren't going to be viable at the prices that which will, you know, are going to transpire.
So, yes or no?
Yes or no what?
Well, are these luxury developments, are they the sorts of things which will carry on? Because the wealthy are not are relatively unaffected by all this. It's the people at the bottom end of society with very little disposable income. They're the ones who are going to be most affected through things like energy prices, rents, transport prices, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, I think what will happen if there's a recession, depression, is that the wealthy will stop building luxury flats, but they've already got luxury flats to live in. They don't need new ones, they've already got them. So that may, the whole thing may just grind to a halt there, but the wealthy will still have the flats they've already bought, unless we're going to requisition them for all the homeless people that we're going to have to find somewhere to live.
Well, another thing that's changing quite a lot at the moment is software and computing. I did mention last week an interview with the guy who runs BitChute, which was done by Dan Dix in Mexico last week. But there's also something this week about Windows. And Windows is something which is changing. Okay, so the computer I'm looking at right now is not a Windows computer, it's a Linux computer. And I think more and more people are going to be going over to this. This is what was predicted maybe even 20 years ago, that other platforms. And the reason why people, it's called Windows hate. People are just getting fed up with Windows and looking for alternatives, apparently. And they're saying that this Windows is, if people go along with Windows, they may see the end of personal computing because they're starting to demand logins and charge. But anyway, let's hear what this commentator has to say about the way Windows has been changing.
First, let's acknowledge the obvious. Windows has gotten more frustrating. Force Microsoft account logins, Copilot buttons appearing in Notepad and Paint, ads in the Start menu and File Explorer, recall rollouts that no one asked for, BitLocker lockouts that corrupt the drive, BitLocker centralized keys tied to a Microsoft account, TPM security chip creating verified identities in a Microsoft account with hardware monitoring, the push for putting your data in the cloud with OneDrive, the constant sales job to use cloud Windows backup, inconsistent updates that break drivers or features. These things are annoying. They make people mad, and they should. But if that was all that was happening, the reaction would be the same old grumbling we've seen for 20 years. What's different now is the volume and the intensity. People aren't just annoyed. They're leaving, switching to Linux, buying Macs, going back to older hardware. Why? Because underneath the surface annoyances is a much larger architectural change. Microsoft is no longer building a personal operating system. They're building the front end for a cloud-first, agent-orchestrated computing platform. And once you see that, everything else starts making sense.
I mean, really, you should ask Dave, what he means when he says cloud first, does that mean the idea is that the data is not stored on your laptop, that it's stored out there somewhere up in the sky on some data server somewhere, yeah? Yeah, so that's the idea, Martin. You know, your data is not going to be on your laptop or on your phone or whatever. It's going to be somewhere on someone, an Amazon server somewhere or a Microsoft server.
Yeah, the other thing about all of this is because they're bringing in this regulation about, you know, to show that you're not a child under 16 or whatever, that means everybody's got to register before you can get in access to the system. And it's basically, that means everybody's basically going to be, you know, be part of the panopticon, yeah?
Well, yeah, that's the theory, but even when you put your passport in, as I've done, the system says no, the OneGov login. I just noticed yesterday, so they're trying to roll this all out right across government to make it so there's some form of digital ID, but it's no good because it doesn't actually work. When you put your data and your information in, it just comes back, the computer says no, and it sends you back to the start again. So if it doesn't recognise someone's passport, I mean, how on other ways is it going to recognise how old you are? You could lie. What are you going to do? You've got to scan your face and then an AI decides whether you're old enough or not. I mean, this is... It seems to me that you do have to have some form of proof of age, but there's lots of other ways to do it. They do it, for example, why not use a system, for example, if you want to buy cigarettes, you know, you've got to prove your age.
Yeah, but obviously, if you're online, you're not going into the shop and they can look at you and say, well, you're too young to buy cigarettes. But obviously, when you're online, obviously, you can.
But even if I've got a digital ID, right, like someone else can use that, can't they?
Yes, of
course.
You
could use it. I mean, the whole thing is that it hasn't actually been thought through. And it was nice to see yesterday an email from, I think it was from Companies House, saying, we're very sorry that our whole system has not been working. We apologise and we've had lots and lots of complaints. Well, I've actually been sent some of my information to our local MP here, Carla Denyer, who's been lobbying against the digital ID system. And so hopefully she and other MPs, this is always the thing to do, folks, don't just bang your head against the computer screen. If you think that there's something illegal going on here and they're going to try and shut you out of something that you've been doing for years because of something digital, then just contact a councillor, MP, and make sure they've got all the knowledge and the information. The funny thing it was about it was I got a call from Carla's researcher in her MP's office here in Bristol to say, what's happening to my email? Because she'd emailed me and it had bounced back three times. And so there was some block, and now apparently it's working fine. But somehow my email was being blocked. Because people have become so dependent, Martin, on email, and yet sometimes email just goes into a black hole and no one ever sees it again.
Yeah, and of course there are plenty of opportunities to spam the system and, you know, pretend to be people you're not and all the rest of it. And of course we can all, you know, a lot of proper, you know, if you want real security, you have to meet people in person, you know, write things down and then rip up the paper, all this sort of stuff.
Well, there's also the fact that actually the whole of society should really be run on this principle of innocent until proven guilty. And then if you are proven guilty, then it surely should be a criminal matter and a police matter. But so often the police don't seem interested in anything. I mean, you know, we were talking last week about violent robbery going on in the in Richmond, in London, in front of everybody. There's no police around. There's no the criminals don't really seem to be even afraid. They don't mind being on CCTV, and they're not afraid that any police are actually going to turn up and apprehend them either.
Well, obviously, what the police would say, and I have got sympathy for this, is we don't have the resources to do what you're asking us to do. That's what, from 2008 onwards.
All the police are sitting in offices behind screens. Like, okay, we talked a bit about this last week. The way things were organised maybe 20, 30 years ago is much different. The police, many of them, most of them, PCs would be out on the beat. They'd be at the front end. They would be trusted to get on with the job out there rather than behind a screen. And also, you'd have the mobile cops in area cars, the 999 response cars driving around every part of any city, even a county, just looking for trouble, basically. Not looking for trouble themselves, but looking for anything that was going on, and also scoping, looking for anyone behaving suspiciously. Nowadays, all you're really seeing out there most of the time is just traffic cops going around who are just looking for people doing speeding offences. And so the whole way that policing is organised now seems to be a kind of desktop thing. We've had, for example, haven't we? We've over the last few months have been covering this story to do with Nick George's being assaulted in southwest London. I can't remember. It's just on top of the M25. They had some banners on a bridge, and some bloke came along and assaulted him, GBH, and fractured his skull. And the police still haven't, I mean, it's actually been up to that Palestine group themselves to go and identify who the person it was they think has done this through social media.
Yeah, well, I mean, in that particular case, it may be that the police are, you know, behaving politically. They don't like this, you know, they don't want to look into this because they, you know, basically they don't really like the idea of people protesting on motorways.
Is it nothing to do with the Palestine-Israel issue, then?
Well, that's right. I mean, as you can see, there's all sorts of legal tricks being used to keep people under thumb in relation to this. As you know, the other week I was stopped by the police for wearing a Palestine Action T-shirt. And, of course, that's what...
Allegedly wearing a Palestine Action T-shirt.
Well, I was wearing one. But the point is that the rules are such that, the Al-Aqsa March, which has been held in London for 40 years on Sunday... They were allowed to have a static rally, but they weren't allowed to have a march. And, of course, the police are basically You know, they're doing the government's will here. They're trying to make it difficult to protest and discouraging people from taking part.
But this is the top echelons of the police. I think it's not prepared to say. It seems to me that's where the problem lies anyway, is the organisation at the top. So anyway, let's get back to the online censorship and this whole idea of cloud first sounds absolutely awful to me. Oh, let's give people hardly any memory, so they have to give all of their information to us. And also, of course, the other thing is subscriptions. So many of the Microsoft services now, such as things like Skype, which used to be free, or they would be, you know, you could update them once every 6 or 8 months or whatever. They're now a subscription service. So you have to subscribe to get any of those. And in fact, the new one, Teams, which has taken over from Skype, is far, far, far worse. It's appalling. And yet you're supposed to be paying every month to use the thing. This is where these big software companies go wrong, I think. There are other ways to get people to use this stuff rather than paid subscriptions, because there's loads of other software out there, free software, and there's loads of other operating systems. We don't need Windows. So anyway, let's have a listen now to Dan Dix chatting with the boss of BitChute in Mexico.
In my opinion, we are the most deplatformed, demonetized, deboosted platform out there. So we've dealt with all kinds: DDoS attacks, removal from hosting providers, removal from banks, removal from payments processors. In fact, at the time that we left the UK, we couldn't get a single bank in the UK or in the entirety of Europe to open an account for us. Yeah, so this has been a real journey, finding out what you have to go up against when you want to support freedom online. But I don't want to complain, because there's a lot of positives here that we were able to survive and move out of the UK. I would say that the final straw for us was the regulation that was coming in, Ofcom in the UK and the Online Safety Act, which meant that if we had stayed, if we had remained, we could literally no longer be BitChute. We would have had to have engaged in censorship and surveillance for the UK government, for Ofcom. So that was the red line. We knew then that we had to move, and we moved the company out of the UK to the US, where we were able to get a bank account and continue operating with our principles of free speech and privacy.
So it's almost like they gave you an ultimatum. It was engage in censorship, start silencing the voices who we tell you to, or we're going to take you down. Was that the options there? And I honestly think it speaks to your integrity to you know, take the platform away rather than cave.
You're exactly right. That was it. If we had remained, you know, and we hadn't, we would have had to have conceded to their Censorship and Surveillance Act. Yeah, otherwise we would have been operating illegally. So we left the UK, and unfortunately we had to block the UK as well in order to completely remove ourselves from there. And unfortunately these laws are coming in all over the world, so it is something that's ongoing, and you know, we're coming up with new ways to resist them, but this is an ongoing thing right now.
Yeah, well, let's talk a little bit about those new ways, because I know, you know, decentralization is key when it comes to all aspects of getting outside of government control. And so what sorts of things are you working towards with the platform BitChute in order to ensure that it's not going to be taken down someday, or that they're not going to try to do what they tried to do to you in the UK?
Yeah, so we operate BitChute largely like YouTube operates at the moment. But we're the one platform, I think, that probably has had to operate only on crypto for the best part of a year. So, you know, we've got experience in just running a business on crypto, which is very difficult, I can tell you. But we're also looking at new decentralized protocols that we can implement into BitChute, and ways that we can make it more resilient while we keep the platform running as it is. These things are important. You need to make sure that we are coming up with actual solutions that will help content creators, not gimmicks. So that's what makes it more difficult, and means that we have to spend more time focusing on what actually works. But
you know, the governments make their moves, and we're making counter moves to make sure that we will be resilient moving forward.
So the government is the enemy of free speech, actually, is effectively what you're saying there. I have my BitChute channel. Now, when I'm uploading to it, Martin, the whole of the world can see the videos I'm putting up there, except the UK.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm not very knowledgeable about this topic, I have to say. So it's interesting to hear what's being said.
But isn't it interesting how it's... But he's saying, basically, this Online Safety Act is doing two things. It's not only censoring lots of material that people are putting up there, and this is not through copyright. It's to do with the government says this is wrong information, you're not allowed to use it. And so we'll take a whole video down for maybe just one word or a couple of sentences that are used in that video. But then the whole point as well is that the government is ordering BitChute to hand over personal private details of people who've got accounts on there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the attempt to control the information space is ongoing at every level.
Why is this happening more in the UK than anywhere else on planet Earth, even more than China?
Well, I mean, I don't know enough about to say whether we're doing it more than China. You know, I don't know enough.
You can see BitChute in China. You can't see it here.
Yeah, but there will be other mechanisms in China for making sure what you don't get to see what they don't want you to see.
Maybe we should try and upload some critical video of President Xi, a parody, maybe mocking him, and see how long it lasts. Anyway, so that's of course the big difference over here. This is kind of normal, but as he's explaining there, there are all sorts of ways that this British government is, and it's not just this one. Obviously, it's the previous government too. This Online Safety Act is trying to shut the internet down effectively and turning it, rather than somewhere where people can freely share knowledge and information, is turning it into a place where everyone can watch what you're sharing, and if they want, they can find out all about you using the companies that are providing these services. Anyway, good old Ray Vahey, that is him there, and we heard previously from the what's his name, Braxman, what's his first name, Dave? Robert Braxman, talking about Microsoft. So always try and keep abreast of these changes on the internet. The other thing, of course, he was saying there, which is in some ways more worrying, is the fact that the banks are deplatforming him because they didn't like him. What on earth has it got to do with them? The bank is saying, well, we don't like BitChute. You're not complying with... someone from the government has phoned us up and said, we're going to just pull your bank account. And he's saying nobody in Europe would give him a bank account, not a single person.
Yeah, well, Jacques Baud, who's a colonel in the Swiss Army, he's been writing very critical stuff about the Ukraine war. And the EU have deplatformed him, and he can't get a bank account. He lives in Switzerland, so he's not even in the EU, but they basically meant that he can't get any bank accounts.
So he just has to have cash under the mattress?
Well, that's right. I mean, people have to go out and buy stuff for him. And
maybe this is what he's saying about crypto. Yeah, they had to run the whole company on crypto.
Yeah, well, I mean, when we say that the internet used to be anybody said what they want and it was all free and so on, that's not necessarily the case. People were deplatformed, people were, you know, they're demonetized. There's various levels they can go through to make you shut up and go away. And, of course, the algos they're using mean that the stuff they want you to see is what pops up and the stuff they don't want you to see doesn't pop up. And that's the nature of the beast, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be this way. I think Britain is doing everything it possibly can to say, oh, we're just trying to protect the kids, and then actually just censoring information which is embarrassing for them. Anyway, it's not just online, of course, it's elsewhere and in our newspapers that censorship is quite rife. And I spoke this week to investigative journalist Eugene Costello, who's been doing a piece about... it's to do with temporary housing, second homes, and this word mis-selling is all over this article he's written, and one of the main mainstream papers has refused to publish. But actually, of course, this is actually fraud, isn't it? He's talking about it. If you're selling a second home to somebody, and what's actually happening is that you're buying something, and you find once you bought it and you move in that everything's different to what it was. This is fraud, isn't it? And yet the newspaper doesn't want to print it, apparently.
Well, it may be that the advertisers for the newspaper are involved in this and they don't want that stuff out there.
Could well be. Anyway, it's the lawyers that he points the finger at. I had a chat with him earlier this week.
I was doing an investigation for a Sunday broadsheet, and as with any investigation, you are required to give a right of reply to the people being complained about, which, of course, I did. Now, after I'd been working on this for a few weeks, I suddenly got a call from the commissioning editor saying, we've got a bit of a problem. We, as in the newspaper's lawyers, have received a letter from a city law firm, a very expensive city law firm, objecting to publication of this story. And I said, well, on what grounds are they objecting? And they said, well, I'll send you the letter. You can read it for yourself. So they did, and they forwarded a highly defamatory letter from the law firm saying, we do not believe that Mr. Costello is an independent journalist, which, of course, is complete nonsense. But they had no objection to the actual story, and this is what I find so shocking, that they can just, you know, play the man rather than the ball and just create enough of a fuss or, you know, some sort of objection that's not based on anything, that's based on nonsense and slander, or libel in the written case. But obviously it had an effect because the commissioning editor told me, don't worry, we've got your back. We've seen all your cuts. We're able to say, of course, he is a professional journalist. And that's a nonsensical suggestion. So this carried on. So I think this was in early January. And then by late February, we're in March now, or early March, I'd have to check the dates, everything was sailing along quite nicely. They'd come back to me with lots of questions about the topic, which I'd answered. So one way or another, the whole thing had taken up a considerable amount of my time over the previous 2 to 3 months and ended up being a much bigger investigation than the one that I had agreed to do. Nevertheless, it got to the point where the chief sub-editor was contacting me at layout stage. It was being laid out to run the paper the following day or the day after. So, you know, everything seemed like it was going along swimmingly. And I answered her questions. And then she sent me a final email saying, just one last query. By now I was getting a bit sick of the whole thing, all the back and forth. You know, it made it a much bigger job than we'd agreed at the outset. But while I was emailing her, saying, okay, I'll have to check my notes and I'll come back to you, she sent me another one saying, actually, the whole fire, because it seems legal, have got an issue, which obviously I thought, what the hell? You know, this was 2 months or so after they'd received this rather scurrilous bullying letter. So I thought, well, why is this coming up again now? And then I got an email from the commissioning editor to saying, really sorry, we've got to pull it on the advice of the lawyers. So I was pretty pissed off, as you can imagine. It was an awful lot of work. And also the objection, as evidenced by the letter from the law firm, was not based on anything factual. It was just libeling me, claiming that I was in the pay of, you know, it was a bit like sort of McCarthyism in America. It was as though they were suggesting that I was an agent for the Communist Party or something. It was just absolutely nonsensical. So I was pretty angry, and they said, well, we'll pay you a kill fee. And because of the way they calculated the kill fee based on a fee for 1,000 words, which is in these days is not especially well paid, it ended up being all. Certainly nothing to compensate me for the many weeks I'd spent on the investigation, and all because these people had used a city law firm, the owner of the particular brand that I had written about is a massive private equity firm domiciled in Jersey, where they have questionable corporate governance and financial governance. So they're no stranger to controversy, I shouldn't think. But I felt really angry that this had been stopped in this way, you know, that I'd had my legs cut out from under me, and not based on anything factual, just, you know, pumping up some sort of vapors to make the thing. And you know, I felt very annoyed with the lawyers for not having the balls to stand by the story. It's a sad state when the Fourth Estate is becoming a fifth column for corporate entities and preventing journalists doing their proper job, which is to speak truth to power and to expose wrongdoing. And I find it absolutely astonishing that a major, major Sunday newspaper, that their lawyers would have the attitude, we're not prepared to take the risk on this story.
So that's Eugene Costello there, speaking to me this week, investigative journalist for a major Sunday newspaper. Now, Martin, this is so frustrating, isn't it? I mean, he's working on this story for a couple of months, and he's told, oh, well, sorry, we're not going to publish it now, and you can have a paltry fee, 150 quid or so, for us to say sorry. At least there is one positive side to this story is likely to come out, but this is about corporate fraud. It's about, you know, this should be the police going into this company and arresting them and putting them on trial for fraud, but instead, they're not even able to get a proper investigation in a Sunday newspaper exposing this fraud.
Well, I mean, obviously, investigative journalists like Eugene. This is it's an ongoing hazard, isn't it? You're always dealing with people who want you to shut up. And of course, eventually you can't make a living as a journalist if you don't toe the line.
This is the Mandelsonian side to this, is that for decades, Peter Mandelson and other people have been going threatening journalists, saying, well, if you want to print that, then I'm going to get you sacked. This sort of thing. So I think journalism is becoming less and less courageous, as he's saying there. And over the years, it's become... I don't know if the courts would be sympathetic. I very much imagine if it all went to court, then Eugene and his newspaper would almost certainly win. But it's just the lawyers. They're saying, oh, well, we don't want to get into trouble. So I'll tell you what.
Well, I mean,
all they've had to do there is send a legal letter with a load of lies in it, and the story has been spiked by that paper. But he does say it probably will come out through another newspaper in the next few weeks.
Well, I mean, that's the game of cat and mouse that he's playing, isn't it?
He shouldn't have to play
He shouldn't.
He's a public servant, really. He's a bit of a hero, yeah, digging all this info out. And, he did a pretty good job in getting close to what the story was about, as close as he possibly could do, because obviously he doesn't want to blow his chances of selling it to another paper.
Well, no. And, of course, it's a minefield, isn't it? I mean, it's not just...
He felt like he'd been just stringed along by the newspaper.
Yeah, well, what that means is...
Strung along.
Well, what that means eventually is that anybody who's thinking of looking into some topic like this will think twice, won't they?
Well, he will be thinking twice. Yeah. This is the idea, is identify people who are damaging our reputation, even though we are a bunch of scallywags, and try and shut them down by what fair means or foul.
Well, that's right. I mean, these people have got very deep pockets.
Maybe the lawyers.
And a very big axe to grind.
Maybe the
they?
Lawyers should be shut down too. Maybe the police should go and feel the collars of these lawyers, saying, hang on a minute, you've just put this statement through. It's a whole load of rubbish. We're going to do you for perjury.
Yeah, well, I mean, the libel laws and all the rest of it in this country are there to protect power. That's effectively what they do. And, of course, lots of investigative journalists, I've spoken to investigative journalists in the past, and I was one of the guys who worked for The Guardian years ago, and he said, well, of 10 stories that I might look into, only one will probably be used. So most of the things we look into, we can't use it because it's the legal, the legal problems are so great. And that was years ago. And so a lot of investigative journalism, you do a lot of investigation. Of course, people used to be paid to do all these investigations, even though 9/10 of them were never going to be published. And that is the way you have to do it.
Okay, well, let's go on and have a look at World War III now. I mean, am I being flippant calling it World War III?
I don't think so. I think everybody needs to wake up and understand what's going on.
The thing is, the other thing, Martin, is it's been escalating. The Israelis have been escalating things. Obviously, they escalate by assassinating the leader. The Americans have accused the Israelis of doing most of these assassinations anyways. Deliberate assassinations is a Israeli thing. And also this week, doing something even more crazy. Well, it's probably just as crazy, which is trying to escalate the whole thing by attacking this gas field, as it Al-Pars gas field.
Yes, and of course the Iranians then responded by attacking gas fields and oil facilities in the Gulf states.
Well, let's start though with the real story of what's going on in Iran itself, which is celebrating the anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. In fact, many people around the world who have sympathies with Shia Islam, in fact, all sorts of Muslims as well. And in fact, people who are not Muslims will go along and celebrate the Iranian Revolution. In a way, you could see Iran as doing a kind of Fidel Castro, couldn't you?
Well, I'm afraid the Cubans are in a much weaker position than the Iranians, because they've cut off all of their oil supplies from Mexico and Venezuela, and they've just in 24-hour blackouts.
But what about my comparison? You Marxists, you love going on about Cuba, and you wear your Che Guevara T-shirts, etc. But actually, the Iranian Revolution was every bit as much of a revolution against Western colonialism, surely.
Of course it was, yes. But Iran is a much more important country. It's a bigger country. It's geographically central. Cuba is effectively a small island. It's not in the same league.
Anyway, in Tehran this week, there weren't loads of people rioting against the government. They were celebrating this Al-Quds Day. So let's have a listen to a little report from Tehran this week.
The mood here is one of resilience and survival, as Iran views the war as existential. Senior Iranian officials were present today, despite open threats against them by the U.S. and Israel. President Masoud Pezeshkian, Foreign Minister Araghchi, Judiciary Chief Mohseni Ejei, and Security Chief Ali Larijani were seen greeting crowds in Tehran. Their message, Iran is not backing down. The rallies came shortly after Iran's new supreme leader, Sayyid Mojtaba Khamenei, issued his first written public statement. From targeting U.S. bases to keeping the strategic Strait of Hormuz closed, his speech signaled the leadership style that is unlikely to prove popular with the Trump administration.
Trump and Netanyahu, I have a message for you. Iranians are not a small group who betrayed their country for your goals. Rather, they are those who are willing to sacrifice themselves, their families, and their children to protect their country.
Extraordinary scenes as millions of people gather across Iran, very much in support of the government. They've been kind of galvanized, Martin, haven't they, over the years by opposition to the United States and Israel particularly.
Well, yes. I mean, the original Gulf War, which went on for 8 years, the West were backing Saddam Hussein all the way, providing chemical weapons for him.
That wasn't the Gulf War. You mean the Iran-Iraq War?
Was a Gulf War. That was the first Gulf War. But the West weren't directly involved. The Iraqis were involved. It's only a technical detail.
What you've got there really is a whole bunch of people celebrating. We're being told over here that it's just one little a few inches and the people of Iran can overthrow their government.
Well, I mean, they can't get the story straight on that one, because the Israelis are going for what is essentially smashing up the civilian infrastructure of the country. And they've killed over 1,000 some odd people, most of them civilians, of them children.
He listed a whole bunch of people there that appeared in this big rally in Tehran greeting the crowds. So what's happened is, in order to avoid them being under surveillance and having Hellfire missiles or any other missile come down onto their head, attracted into their mobile phone or whatever it is, what's happening is many of the Iranian leaders are doing these kind of almost like celebrity pop-ups. They'll just suddenly appear amongst the crowds.
Yes, and of course the bombing was continuing while there was protesting, so people can hear the bombs going off. And in fact, they ought to get into shelters and things, but I think the attitude is we're going to go out in the streets and show everybody that we're not backing down. The Israelis, of course, aren't doing that. They're hiding in the shelters.
So this seems to be a deliberate tactic of the United States and Israel, but particularly Israel, is to try and make the country ungovernable.
Yeah, well, I think the goal of the Israelis is to turn Iran into a version of Syria or Libya. It's not even regime change. They just want the place smashed up and not able to threaten them. That's the idea. I mean, it's pretty crazy stuff. Because, of course, the Iranians have got plenty of cards to play, and they're playing them.
What are the big developments you think? I mentioned this week the attack on the oil field, the gas field. The Israelis are clearly trying to ramp things up, aren't they? They're trying to, and also force the Iranians to retaliate. And he's also talking there about the US air bases. Well, that might include RAF Fairford, possibly.
Well, the Iranians have already said the British bases like Akrotiri are going to be targets because British bases are being used to bomb our country. You know, if the Iranians were sending planes here to bomb our country, we would think it was okay to hit their air bases, wouldn't we? And that's exactly the reality of the situation, isn't it?
Well, let's just hear a report now on this specific escalation this week, which is as Netanyahu and his friends decide that they're going to attack this gas field, which is a joint Qatari and Iranian gas field. The idea, of course, being, and it was successful, to provoke the Iranians to attack Gulf gas installation.
Iran has carried out attacks on energy facilities in the Gulf, hitting major sites in Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Qatar says the strikes caused extensive damage at Ras Laffan, the world's largest liquefied natural gas production facility. Those attacks came after Israel hit Iran's South Pars gas field, part of the world's biggest gas reserve, shared with Qatar. President Trump has warned Iran against targeting Qatar's Ras Laffan again. And in a social media post, he said the U.S. was not involved in the Israeli strike on South Pars. Qatar's now expelled several Iranian diplomatic staff. The foreign ministry says Iran's military and security attaches and their teams should leave Qatar within 24 hours. Okay, well, I'm joined by Mohammed El-Masri. He's a professor of media studies at the Doha Institute for Graduate Studies to take a look at all of these developing stories. So, Mohammed, firstly, on the Israeli attack on Iran's side of the shared gas fields in the Arabian Gulf. It's called the South Pars Field. For the Iranians, it's called the North Field or the North Dome here in Qatar. It's a zone of hugely strategic cooperation, isn't it? But when it comes to this attack on South Pars, Donald Trump says he knew nothing about Israel's plan to attack the field, but insists no more attacks will be made by Israel. Who's calling the shots here?
It was a really interesting post, and it's generating a lot of discussion online. It's easy to imagine here that Trump is not telling the truth, that he authorized this, that Israel would not have done this without his authorization, but that he's just trying to calm the markets and allay the fears of his Gulf allies. However, it's also not difficult to imagine that Benjamin Netanyahu has once again gotten his way with Donald Trump and forced the hand of the Trump administration. Netanyahu has been to Washington 7 times over the past 13 or 14 months, and he has pretty much gotten his way. And it's to such an extent that even Trump's own MAGA base is starting to question whether it is Israel that is actually dictating many facets of American foreign policy. And on that note, there was Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, a couple of weeks ago, who sort of let the cat out of the bag, if you will, by suggesting that it was Israel who sort of forced the hand of the United States to attack Iran once again.
Why would it strategically then be in Israel's favor to attack South Pars, knowing that the Iranians would retaliate against Qatar, an ally of the United States? What's the purpose here?
Well, I mean, certainly this serves the Israeli purpose. The Israeli purpose is to create chaos. They would like to generate, of course, a collapse of the state in Iran, but also I think they would love to generate chaos in the Gulf and in the wider Middle East region. Israel's goal, going back many years, one of their goals is to create weak, fragmented, subordinated states and to become the region's only true power. Benjamin Netanyahu has been speaking recently about Israel becoming a global superpower. He has mentioned previously his greater Israel ambitions. Israel, of course, is an expansionist state. It is seeking to expand its borders. So this is all part of that. So we can see how this benefits Israel from their perspective. But the interesting thing is that it doesn't really seem to be benefiting anyone else. It's catastrophic, I think, certainly for the Gulf countries, for Europe, and I would argue for the United States as well.
So that's an Al Jazeera report. Quite interesting, of course. So they're talking about this oil field, which is just off their own coast, gas field that they share with Iran. But it's good to see there's some actually pretty balanced reporting from Al Jazeera, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, obviously Al Jazeera is run by the government of Qatar, so there's certain things they can and other things they're not going to.
Yeah, but they're
say.
Not instantly blaming Iran at no. all, are they? No. They're trying to take quite a... What do you think? Do you think Trump was lying when he said he didn't know about it and he's told Netanyahu
quite,
not to do it again?
I think it's quite possible that Netanyahu is doing things without telling Trump. We don't know. They may have conferred.
Well, Trump has now said he's not going to allow them to do it again. Now, Trump is obviously thinking quite clearly about oil prices, and he's saying, look, energy prices, we don't want to have some... I don't want the whole world's collapse of finance due to energy to be blamed on me. And if Netanyahu carries on like this, that's what's going to happen.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's an interesting tug of war between them, isn't it? The Israelis...
Is it a game? Do you think it's real? Or is this just a bit of a game play?
Well, look, the two main principles in this, Israel and the US, do not necessarily have the same goals. There's lots of overlap, but they're pulling in different directions. The Israelis are quite happy to pull the house down on everybody. The Americans, because, you know, Trump's a businessman, are saying, well, hang on a minute, that's going to crash the global economy. But the Israelis don't care.
But surely Trump actually doesn't really mind, say, the European economy collapsing and the Europeans happy to buy American energy, does he?
No, he doesn't. I mean, when he came out, he said, well, the oil price will rise and that will be good for us because we'll make loads of money. What he means is make loads of money for U.S. oil companies, right. And of course the ordinary punters will still have to pay the increased prices.
Well, that's his voters. Maybe he's just given up. Or maybe because he hasn't got any chance of a second term, maybe he's thinking, well, I don't care, really.
Well, I mean, who knows what's going on in the brain of Donald Trump at the moment?
I don't think even he knows.
And that's
he?
Right.
Anyway, he mentioned there Marco Rubio, who is the Secretary of State now in the States, and his little confession. And I probably should have played that literally last week, because it is quite important, isn't it? Rubio is saying he thinks the whole war was really started by the Israelis.
But what Rubio said was, we knew that the Israelis were going to start the war. We couldn't tell them not to, which is what should have happened. And therefore, we joined in because we knew we were going to be immediately attacked by the Iranians. So we might as well be hungry.
Well, anyway, only about half a minute. So let's have a listen now to what Rubio said last week.
If we stood and waited for that attack to come first before we hit them, we would suffer much higher casualties. And so the president made the very wise decision. We knew that there was going to be an Israeli action. We knew that that would precipitate an attack against American forces. And we knew that if we didn't preemptively go after them before they launched those attacks, we would suffer higher casualties and perhaps even higher those killed. And then we would all be here answering questions about why we knew that and didn't act.
Well, that's missing the point. What I said earlier is the point. The Americans should have told the Israelis, you are not to do that. And previous US presidents would have done exactly that.
Well, it shows you who's in charge, doesn't it? The Israelis are in charge.
Well, that's right. That's what the Epstein files were all for.
Mm.
And they've got their thing, you know, they've made a big plan over many years to do what they're doing.
This is an amazing and massive admission, isn't it? Saying this is a preemptive strike. Really, we only did this because we knew that the Israelis were about to attack Iran. We knew that as a result, the Iranians would most likely attack some American forces in the region. And so we thought, well, we would have to attack them first. Now, this isn't really going to go down well with the world public if it starts a third world war.
No, it's not. I mean, it's all, let's be clear about this, all of this is illegal in international law, and everybody involved in it is a war criminal.
Isn't it crisis initiation? The idea is this is actually a sort of technical term to try and get a war going. Someone who thinks they're going to maybe be able to take advantage financially or through land and land grabbing during a war.
I mean, one of the things that's been going on is all the people in Trump's family and his acolytes, every time he switches one of his policies around, he gives everybody a heads up and they all go and bet on the stock market to get money. And he's personally made loads of money while he's been president. So there's no shame about, you know, well, I'm here to enrich myself and my family. Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, is just basically massive scam artist.
Let's have a listen to Benjamin Netanyahu just yesterday speaking about all of this, because he's suddenly, the heat is on him from the world's press, and particularly from the Israeli press, saying listen, mate, you started this, and in fact you encouraged the United States to do it.
And I want to close these opening remarks with one other fake news, and that is that Israel somehow dragged the U.S. into a conflict with Iran. Does anyone really think that someone can tell President Trump what to do? Come on. President Trump always makes his decisions on what he thinks is good for America, and may I add, I think what is also good for future generations. In this case, those interests are absolutely clear, and so is the clarity of our achievements. Together in close coordination with President Trump, the close coordination between America and Israel, our militaries, our intelligence services, we're achieving goals in lightning speed. But I want to say another word. It's been said that for 40 years, I've been saying that Iran is a danger to Israel and a danger to the world. That is true. You know who else said that? President Trump. 47 years ago, when the Iranian thugs took over the American embassy, he said how dangerous this regime is. In his first term in office, he didn't need any convincing. He said the Iranian nuclear deal was the worst deal that he'd ever seen, and he walked out of it. Right before his second term, before he was reelected, I went to see him in Mar-a-Lago. The first thing he said to me was, "Bibi, we've got to make sure that Iran doesn't have nuclear weapons." He said that to me. I didn't say it to him. He didn't need any convincing there either. Now, why did he say that? Because for more than four decades, this regime, as I said in the beginning of my remarks, is chanting death to Israel, death to America. But they say Israel is only the small Satan standing in their way. The great Satan is the United States of America. And these ideological fanatics, these lunatics, define their raison d'etre, their reason for being, is wiping out Western civilization and America that leads it. They have claimed the lives, they've maimed and wounded thousands of Americans in Iraq and Afghanistan. They killed the American Marines in Beirut. They bombed your embassies. They tried to assassinate the American president, Donald Trump, not once, but twice. Now they blackmail for oil. Just imagine what they would do, what they're capable of doing, if these lunatics had nuclear weapons and the means to deliver them to every American city and every European city and everywhere around the globe. This is a danger for the entire world. It's certainly a danger for Israel. It's certainly a danger for America. We see eye to eye on that, President Trump and I, Israel and America. But I think if people are honest, if leaders are honest, they would understand that we're not only fighting our fight, we're fighting their fight. I speak to dozens of world leaders. Dozens. They all know that. And privately, they all say that. They say that privately, but I say it publicly. The world owes a debt of deep indebtedness, to President Trump for leading this effort to safeguard our future.
So he begs to differ with Mr. Rubio, Martin.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't take anything he says seriously. I mean, they make stuff up. They lie. He lies. Trump lies. And once you've been caught out lying, we're absolutely entitled to say, well, we just don't believe you. about anything.
No, well, yes, you are. And he's talking there also about this massive threat to civilization that Iran poses. And I'd just like to point out that the bombing that's been going on, mostly by the Israelis, the Iranian cultural sites, 200 so far have been damaged. This is historic sites, ancient palaces, historic mosques and landmarks that are embedded deep in Iran's history and Persian history and stretch back centuries, have become collateral damage in the US-Israeli war on the country, although that actually, they may have been deliberately targeted. At least 56 cultural sites, museums, and Al Jazeera says 200, and historical buildings have been destroyed, according to Iranian news agency WANA, citing Iran's Ministry of Cultural Heritage, Tourism and Handicrafts. 29 properties across Iran are designated as World Heritage Sites by UNESCO, the UN agency that promotes international cooperation in education, science and culture. They verified damage to several properties so far. One is the opulent, centuries-old Golestan Palace in Tehran, which appeared to have endured significant damage after strikes. Shards of glass, hunks of stone litter the floors. Similar scene unfolded hundreds of kilometres south in the historic city of Isfahan. The windows of the Chehi Sotun Palace have also been blown out, leaving glass scattered all over the ground and rubble. So, I mean, this is interesting, isn't it? This is just from the Globe and Mail, which I think is a Canadian paper. I'm not. Yes, it is. Yeah. So the both of them are UNESCO designated sites. The Israelis are pummeling. So, but they're saying that actually it's the Iranians that are trying to destroy civilization.
The Iranians are much older as a civilization than the United States. I mean, they've been there literally thousands of years, and the language has been spoken. The Farsi, the Persian language, has been spoken in that part of the world for thousands of years. And the United States didn't exist when the Persian Empire was at its height. Nobody even knew the United States was there.
So, is it, I mean, I'm sure the Israelis will say, oh, we're sorry about bombing these historic cultural sites. We were actually having targets which were nearby.
Well, I don't believe that. I mean, if you look what's happening in Lebanon, they're basically saying, everybody get out of South Lebanon, because we're going to reduce it all to rubble. They're in the process of reducing South Lebanon to rubble as we speak. But, of course, it's not going their way. If you follow it closely, you will see that Hezbollah have knocked out quite a few of their tanks, and they're not actually able to move around on the ground in the way that they want to. And, of course, they're getting frustrated, so they just kill more people, because that's what they know how to do.
Well, we had a little clip of Mark Rubio just now. What about Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of War in the States? And I suppose you could almost see us building up to a great crescendo with the Emperor himself speaking on this show in a little while. But anyway, Hegseth is an interesting character, isn't he? This whole sort of quest for the rebuilding of the Third Temple is rather worrying, and he's saying things like that Trump is anointed by Jesus to bring Jesus back. And he's, as we heard last week, if anyone was listening at the very end of last week's show, we had a quote from, or we had an excerpt from Matt Eretz's talk on the Donut Factory from tail end of last year, looking at Hegseth and his massive tattoo that he's got on his chest of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and implying this bizarre concept, Martin, as I was saying right at the very start, that there are Christian Zionists in the United States who actually don't care about Jewish Zionists at all, and they're quite happy to sacrifice them all if it brings back Jesus.
Well, I mean, this is certifiably crazy stuff, but lots of people believe it, and it has an effect in the real world, doesn't it?
I'm not sure that many really do. I think it's that those that do, almost like psychopaths, have been identified and put into positions of authority, which is why the whole progress of this war is extremely worrying when people like that are actually in charge of it rather than proper professional soldiers or airmen or whatever. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Hegseth this week and his press conferences. He likes to pray at his press conference, which I find really the most gut-wrenching thing almost known to man.
So I'll close with scripture, drawing strength from Psalm 144. Blessed be the Lord, my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. He is my loving God and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield, in whom I take refuge. May the Lord grant unyielding strength and refuge to our warriors, unbreakable protection to them and our homeland, and total victory over those who seek to harm them. And amen. God bless our troops and this mission.
Yes, but which God, Pete? Yeah, which God, mate? So that's the sort of thing that's coming out at the end of his speeches these days. He's quoting their Psalms, Old Testament stuff. I mean, this guy's supposed to be a Christian. He's, you can, of course, in context, use the Old Testament, but it seems to me that he's actually far more interested in the pre-Christian version of the faith, where it's an eye for an eye, and there's none of this nonsense about love your enemy.
Yes. I mean, there's plenty of mainstream Christian leaders who are absolutely appalled by what they would regard as the abuse of the Bible. And, the thing is, it's not that many people believe in this, as you say, but they're important because they're in positions of power. Yeah. If you actually believe that we need to have an apocalypse in the Middle East for Jesus to come back, then that's not really a rational military strategy, is it?
No. Anyway, what do you make of Tulsi Gabbard and her role in all this? She's been saying various things. You were a big fan of hers before Trump was elected. In fact, she was a Democrat senator, I think, wasn't she, or a congresswoman?
Yeah.
And Trump brought her in as the head of national security because he thought she'd be a safe pair of hands. What do you make of her?
Well, she's basically sold out in order to keep her position within the Trump administration. She's had to go along with
all
this.
But that is a tactic, isn't it? Some would say you've sold out by staying a member of the Labour Party.
Yes, well, I mean, the point is, I might, at some point I might not be, but with her, she made the decision that she was going to join the administration, and she was basically sidelined from the get-go. And what in the past, she's been very anti having a war with Iran, but she's come out in the last week or so and saying, well, we have to do it. Now that's writing her off, really, because if at the crucial moment you don't say what needs to be said, then we're not going to ask you for your opinion in the future.
What she actually said was that I presented the secret intelligence, and Donald Trump made the decision. That's his job.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't believe what she says either. I mean, the fact is, what people say is not necessarily what they're actually doing. They can say anything they like, can't they?
Well, yes, I suppose that's freedom of speech. But she says the Iran regime is intact, for example, yesterday she was saying.
Well, that's just obvious, isn't it? It's just a statement of the obvious.
Donald Trump is saying the opposite. He's saying they're destroyed.
Well, he can say it as much as he likes. The reality is it's not. It's quite likely that Trump will go down before the regime in Iran. I think that's quite a likely outcome.
Also, the US Senate is asking Tulsi Gabbard if the Iran threat was actually imminent. She is saying effectively no. I mean, that seems to me what's... so it was up to the president to make the decision. So she's obviously not going along with this. She seems to me Tulsi Gabbard has decided she wants to distance herself from this decision by saying it's all up to the president.
Well, yes, but I mean, in actual fact, if she had any integrity, she'd resign. Why not?
Well, what about this other chap that's resigned? His name's Joe Kent. What do you make of him?
Well, he's a very, very pro-Trump, and he's very, very militarist. If you look at his general opinions, they're rather objectionable. But, of course, in actual fact, he won't go along with it because there was no threat to the US. There just wasn't any. It was a threat to Israel, but not to the US. Israel's a long way away from the US.
At her hearing yesterday, Tulsi Gabbard, the Director of National Intelligence in the States, these accusations were put to her about whether or not there was a threat.
Early in this administration, high-ranking Israeli officials and influential members of the American media deployed a misinformation campaign that wholly undermined your America First platform and pro-war sentiments to encourage a war with Iran. This echo chamber was used to deceive you into believing that Iran posed no imminent threat to the United States and that you should strike now. There was a clear path to a swift victory. This was a lie and is the same tactic the Israelis used to draw us into a disastrous Iraq war. Now, I cannot say how much I disagree with that statement. Do you agree or disagree with what this letter was put out by former Director Kent?
He said a lot of things in that letter. Ultimately, we have provided the president with the intelligence assessments, and the president is elected by the American people and makes his own decisions based on the information that's available to him.
Well, I mean, what's beginning to happen is victory has many fathers, defeat is an orphan. So people are trying to get themselves, it wasn't my fault that we did this and this and this.
I actually quite like Tulsi Gabbard still. I think she's there making it absolutely clear. I told him, and then he's made his own decision. This is nothing to do with me.
Well, I mean, that therefore...
She's distancing herself
potentially,
from it.
Yeah. It potentially gives her a chance to be involved in politics going forward.
Well, I think it's important that somebody with some integrity like her, maybe she still has, is in that job. Because you can guarantee at this stage, if she is ejected from that position, then there'll be somebody much more hawkish is put in there.
Yes, but at a certain point, you know, you've got to walk the talk. I mean, ultimately, this is an absolutely illegal war. We know who signed it.
Why don't you walk the talk and join the Green Party?
I might. I haven't said anything about that.
When?
No, I might. I just don't know, Tony. Maybe I'm going to go and live in Ireland and join Sinn Féin.
It just seems to me that everyone and anyone can be part of an organisation. They make their own personal, private decision as to whether they can stay in that organisation and fight for what they believe, or else it's time to walk away. So that's a very personal decision that she's made. She's staying.
Yes, and of course what it does is it gives the regime in the United States some cover. If they really
I don't think she's giving them any cover.
All right,
there.
Well, you're happy with what she's doing. I'm not happy with what she's doing, Tony.
She's not going to lay into Trump, is she? But she's doing everything she can except directly saying he's an idiot.
Well, that's what she should be saying, isn't it? I'm sorry.
She can't.
She could. She'd have to resign, like the other chap.
Yeah, well, so if you were to say that Keir Starmer was an idiot, you'd probably have to resign from the Labour Party.
No, I'm allowed to say he's an idiot.
Are you?
I'm also a member of the Labour Party, and he can't.
Is he an idiot? Is he?
Well, he's not an idiot like Trump, but of course, what he is a very, very incompetent middle management type. Mm. That's what he is.
Yeah, he seems to be sort of quite AI, the sort of person you can get one of those little SD cards and stick it into him want him to say something, put it on the card and he'll say it. He seems to be the sort of person who will just read any old script that's put in front of him because he knows which side his bread is Mandelsonian buttered on. Look, Iran, there is a terrific program we have on here from time to time. I have clips from it called Deep Dive Perspective with Mohsin Abbas. He's based in London and he does all sorts of interesting interviews on there. He even deigned to interview me a few weeks ago about the Epstein business, along with Ryan Dawson, who's absolutely fascinating. If you haven't seen that, it's well worth a look. Ryan is, he's been banging away at the Epstein files ever since, for the last 15 years or so, since there was a first hint about what was going on there. So, but this week, Mohsin has interviewed, in fact, just yesterday, Professor Mohamed Mirandi from Iran, Tehran University, and asked him all about what he thinks is of some of the key issues between Iran and the West.
We have to first remember that the sin of the Iranian people and the Lebanese resistance, Hezbollah, and the Iraqi resistance, and Ansarullah and the people of Yemen, is that they support the Palestinian people. They are opposed to genocide and ethnic cleansing and ethno-supremacism. That is their sin. And this alliance, this axis of resistance, is very much alone. We just saw the statement put out by the Turkish, Saudi, Egyptian, Pakistani, Kuwaiti, Emirati, Bahraini, Qatari, Omani regimes, along with others, condemning Iran, attacking Iran, just like with the UN Security Council resolution, whereas this war was imposed on the Iranian people. And the Iranians are only retaliating against those who carried out the war. And of course, the United States is using its bases in the Persian Gulf region and across the region to fight against Iran. So these regimes that are all complicit, almost all complicit, at least Turkey, Jordan, and the family dictatorships in the Persian Gulf, they are, and the regime in Azerbaijan, in Baku, they are all complicit in this war against the Iranian people. They all have blood on their hands. They're all being agents of the empire. So Iran, without a doubt, will continue striking U.S. bases and U.S. assets across the region. But at least we're now seeing the divide. This is, I think, an event. Everyone has been exposed, from Erdogan to Sisi to Mohammed bin Salman to the despots across the Persian Gulf. They've all been exposed. The world now sees who they are, and the world sees who the axis of resistance is. And the world sees the true nature of the Israeli regime. It's since October the 7th, it's become fully exposed. And that, I think, in itself is a major victory. That's a moral victory. Yeah. And people across the world have to choose sides. For 47 years, the resistance, the Islamic Republic of Iran, its allies have all been demonized by the Western media, by the oil and gas rich regimes and their media empires, and of course the Erdogan regime, among others. But now people are seeing who is standing up against the empire, the Epstein class, the Epstein coalition, and who is complicit and cooperating with the Zionists and Operation Epstein Fury. That, I think, is huge. Just like the genocide and Holocaust in Gaza itself, the ongoing genocide. The biggest defeat for the Israeli regime was that it was exposed. Before October the 7th, few people across the world were following events in Palestine. Most people were ignorant about the nature of the Israeli regime and its history. But the genocide caused people to do research. It caused people to wake up. And I think that is the biggest defeat of the Israeli regime. So this war that we're now seeing being played out for the last 3 weeks almost against the resistance and against Iran in particular is an extension of that awakening. So it's a victory. At another level, it is a major victory for the resistance in the Islamic Republic of Iran at the military level, because the invincible empire that has been ruling the globe on its own, this hyperpower, as it was called, for decades now, especially after the collapse of the Eastern Bloc, this empire, this invincible empire, has failed. And it's not even like Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam even, because in those countries, they succeeded in occupying either the entire countries or significant parts of countries. But in Iran, they failed to be able to occupy the country for the last 3 weeks, despite bringing all their assets to the region and being a coalition and having the full support of the collective West and their regional proxies. And Iran is striking back. They, out of desperation, we saw them strike Iranian key infrastructure, and Iran hit back very hard. And basically, Trump was put out a Truth Social statement saying that Israel will not do this again. He threatened Iran, of course, but it showed Iran's strength. He had to back down. So Iran is striking U.S. assets, Zionist assets, and the empire is outraged. But they failed. So Iran has won at the military level. But also, I think that a further achievement is that despite the global propaganda, this awakening goes beyond our region, and it goes beyond race or religion. Across the world, people are siding with the resistance. People are siding on the side of the Islamic Republic of Iran. For 47 years, they've heard nothing but anti-Iranian propaganda, anti-resistance propaganda. And they now see right through that propaganda because they see that the only entity that is standing against genocide is the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Axis of Resistance. So they conclude that all the anti-Iranian propaganda that we've been hearing for 47 years about the so-called regime being evil, killing its own people, and all the other nonsense that we hear in the West, all of that propaganda has melted.
Yeah, so is he right? Is it really a victory, a moral victory, a victory of hearts and minds as people are waking up to what Iran is really like?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a very painful situation for everybody. But on the other hand, there's a lot of truth in what he's saying, because the Americans and the Israelis just haven't thought through their military strategy here. And the Iranians have. It's clear.
So, and why haven't they? How haven't they?
Well, the whole... I've just got this book about the library called The Allure of Battle, which I've read before. The thing is, they had to win within the first week. That was the whole idea. The first week will decapitate
Didn't
them.
Didn't Putin say the same?
No, Putin... Don't forget what Putin did when they intervened in the Ukraine, is they were trying to force a negotiation, which is what they did, and in actual fact, there was an agreement signed in Istanbul, and then good old Boris Johnson went and stomped all over it. The Iranians, on the other hand, have been doing... You know, they've done everything that's been asked of them. You know, every time they've been asked, they've said, OK, we'll do what you ask. And they had a deal on the table in Amman, which would have given the Israelis and the Americans virtually everything they wanted.
As Peter Ford said last week on this programme, former ambassador to Syria and Bahrain, he said the Israelis won't take yes for an answer.
That's right. And all this stuff about their nuclear weapons is fraudulent, because they know for a fact that they haven't got it. If they did have some, they'd say, we've got some, can you stop this now, otherwise we'll use them. But of course, there may be, going forward, they've got the capability to build a bomb, and once they've actually won the first round of the conventional war, they may just say, right, and we've built a bomb now, have a think about that. Because they could. No reason why they couldn't.
Well, we're going to go back to Mohamed Mirandi before the break, but before that, well, let's have a listen to Mick Lynch, RMT, their union, in fact. There's this thing called the Royal Fleet Auxiliary, and the Merchant Navy, I think they used to be called. They are lots of the Mick Lynch. We think of him as a train workers' union guy, but actually, apparently, lots of the RMT members are on ships.
Yeah, well, it's a transport union, isn't it?
So rail, maritime, transport. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, let's get his take on what's been going on.
So they support the fleet and put themselves in danger, but they have suffered an awful lot of cutbacks and non-investment, if you like, and their fleet, the Royal Fleet Auxiliary vessels, are very depleted, and some of them are knackered, I think is the word you'd say, and being scrapped as we speak. So I think it was on scrapped last week. So they're in a parlous state. So Britain's response, whatever you think of that response, is not going to be that effective if you haven't invested for nearly 20 years, I suppose, or more. But on the point about Starmer, you said the metaphor was the bridge. He probably feels like more of a doormat this morning, the way he's been treated by all sorts of people. And I'm not usually a massive supporter of Starmer, but I think he's made the right choice. He has a duty as the Prime Minister, and the government has a duty to defend British personnel, British assets, British people, British interests. And he's right not to commit to this war. This is an invasion of a sovereign country, whether we like that government or not. This is a sovereign government that we recognise, and it's been invaded without notice, a preemptive strike, as it's been called, and it's Israel's war, ultimately. Israel is getting what it wants out of this situation. More than one country is under attack. All of its Arab neighbours are receiving incoming death, if you like. one way or the other. Lebanon is about to be massively invaded. Beirut is going to be attacked, and it is being attacked now. People are dying all over the region, and the majority of them are people that Israel regards as hostile. Now, that's a situation that...
Well, they are hostile.
Well, not all of them are hostile.
Great, many of them are hostile Israel to many degrees.
What I'm saying is that the conflagration has broken out all over the region, and that is at the instigation, as even Mark Rubio said, of the Israeli government. They said that they were going to strike, and we've got to get in behind them.
Well, I think that's it's partly the case that Israel has been existentially threatened by Iran and is especially threatened by the development of the Iranian nuclear program outside any kind of...
Well, we were told it was destroyed a couple of months ago.
This is where I think we will go wrong, to be honest with you. I think if we start to get into sort of gotchas about whether something that Donald Trump said turns out to be 100% copper-bottom truth
There should be some truth.
Just very quick.
Can I just put a point back to... So hang on, because you were told by Donald Trump, do you therefore believe that... you believe Donald Trump so much that you think there's no threat from Iran, there's no threat from the nuclear capability outside every agreement. Remember also that the British government...
We've got,
and the Australian government and the Canadian government, these are not like mad right-wing governments.
What we've got is...
think that there is a problem.
What we've got is Starmer trying to take a logical position based on his own beliefs and the interests of the country that he's in charge of. He's got to make that decision.
You said it was all about Israel.
It is about Israel. Israel has instigated this war.
There's Mick Lynch from the Rail, Maritime and Transport Union. I suppose Martin quite sensibly trying to keep some of his members out of this and going along, saying Mr. Starmer's actually made a fairly tough decision here.
Yeah, well, I can't quite agree with that. I mean, the Iranians themselves have said it's all very well saying that you're not participating in the war, but British bases are being used to bomb our civilians. They just are. So Starmer's basically trying to have his cake and eat it and saying, well, we're going to be doing defensive things, so we're going to shoot down missiles that the Iranians are firing towards Israel. But they wouldn't be firing the missiles towards Israel if the Israelis weren't bombing Iran. And the Iranians have been pretty clear, if you carry on down this road, we regard you as belligerents and we're going to kill your soldiers. Because lots of ours are already dead. It's time for you to have some.
Mamet Mirandi on the Deep Dive Perspective yesterday was saying he really does think that this could be a third world war.
What we're experiencing today and witnessing today is a world war of sorts. It's a war where the Epstein class wishes to preserve its dominance. And as AI and the new technologies are being developed, they wish to have imposed complete control over the rest of the world. And so in a sense, it is a world war of sorts. And we see that through the statements made by these Arab or so-called Muslim regimes against Iran, just like the UN Security Council's resolution against Iran, which say nothing about the aggression. They say nothing about the war and the murder of Iranian children and Iran's leader. It says nothing about the fact that Iranian key assets and installations and infrastructure have been repeatedly bombed. It says nothing about the fact that hospitals are being bombed, schools are being bombed, ambulances are being bombed. It says nothing about that. All these, when you look at that, when you look at the statement put out by these regimes bound to the West and the UN Security Council resolution that says nothing about the aggression and Iran's right to retaliate against U.S. bases and U.S. assets and Zionist bases and assets. When you look at all that, it is a global war.
And
it is a global war. It is a global war against the oppressed, against the victims of empire, but they are failing. The ruling class in the West, the Zionists, the Epstein class, they're failing. And the regional proxies and NATO can do nothing about it. And the Europeans, out of fear for what is happening, are very cautious. They're trying to disobey their masters in Washington. But the fact that they carried out this attack, the fact that they continue with this war, despite the fact that the Strait of Hormuz is closed and the price of energy is going up, shows that the Israeli regime has no regard for, and the Zionist lobby and the Epstein class have no regard for the international community. It's interesting, in India, the prime minister who went to Israel and pledged some sort of unofficial allegiance to the regime or alliance, the regime, the Israeli regime, through this war is wrecking the Indian economy. And in order to prevent mass unemployment and misery in India and in Pakistan and the subcontinent, it allowed a couple of ships to get through despite the war. But the Israeli regime doesn't care about Americans or American citizens or European citizens or Indian citizens or Chinese citizens. They only care about themselves because they're ethno-supremacists. For them, it's not just the Palestinians that are Amalek. Everyone is Amalek because they are the chosen people. They are the master race. So when you are above and beyond everyone else, that means everyone else is subhuman.
So that is Professor Mohamed Mirandi speaking on the Deep Dive Perspective show with Mohsin Abbas yesterday. Martin, this is again using this language of the Nazis, isn't it? The master race.
Well, I mean, Pete, the Israel lobby and the Zionists, tear their hair out and start shrieking if they're compared to the Nazis. But within Israel itself, people who are critical of the regime do say this is like the Nazis. And of course it is like the Nazis. It's not quite the same. It's not quite the same as Genghis Khan. But there you are. It's bad.
Let's look at the targeting that's been going on. He's alluding to there. I've just been looking at, you go through the firewalls, the various firewalls, and you find out what's actually, I mean, they do this rather bizarre thing on the Western press and Channel 4 News, etc. We managed to get somebody who would speak in Iran, and much dangerous to themselves. They were reporting, well, actually, if you want to see what's going on in Iran, just watch press TV. They have loads of reports on the various damage. So just for one example, yesterday there was a report on press TV I was watching about a car dealership, one of the main, because Iran has its own car manufacturers, and their own Iranian car manufacturers, say, you know, like, so the Germans might have Mercedes, they have their guys, and the Israelis apparently bombed their main maintenance depot, so people who've got their Mercedes cars or whatever they are in Iran, as they're taking them in, all their cars are blown up and then they can't fix the cars anymore.
Well, then they've got a problem trying to find military targets, because what they're trying to get at is the missiles and the launchers, but they're very heavily concealed, so it's quite difficult to get them, so they're not able to do much about that, but they can blow up your factory that makes cars. So they're actually destroying the Iranian economy, and they're trying to push Iran into being a failed state with lots of sub-states, like in Syria. Because, of course, in Syria, the Syrian army, the Al-Qaeda army, is now lined up on the Lebanese border, and they're cooperating with the Israelis to attack Hezbollah in South Lebanon. So,
do you want to just say something about what's happening in Lebanon? This is pretty crazy, isn't it? This is all happening in parallel. This was, they started this Lebanon war at the same time as the Gaza genocide, and now this is just an excuse to kind of carry it on.
Yeah, well, I think what happened there, the Israelis were planning to invade Lebanon, and of course there's supposedly been a ceasefire, which they've been ignoring completely. But Hezbollah decided that they were not going to wait, and they started attacking the Israelis before they were ready. And the Israelis, although they're killing lots of people, they've bombed lots of stuff in Beirut, you know, they're killing loads of civilians, they're bombing ambulances, they're going for first responders and all the rest of it. What they're not able to do is deal with the Hezbollah Radwan guerrillas who are actually ensconced in all
the
Israelis.
The Israelis want to take over the whole of the south of Lebanon, don't they?
They do,
and they're
yeah.
also net right now hammering Beirut.
That's right, but they can't actually get in to Lebanon because Hezbollah are dug in tunnels and
but,
also
but I mean,
they're very good at taking down
it's frustrating because they can bomb from the air or throw mortars and artillery over ad infinitum. The Lebanese are doing nothing to dissuade them, so they could just do this forever and ever unless the Lebanese and Hezbollah are prepared to actually engage the Israeli soldiers on the ground.
Well, they are. That's exactly what they're doing. Yes, they are doing that. The problem is that the Lebanon is a very fragile state, and they had a major civil war there in the 1970s, and the Israelis are trying to restart that civil war. They're trying to put, you know, the Christian militias to fight with Hezbollah and so on. And of course, if you think about Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, all of these countries are in a miserable state as a result of our happy interventions over the last 20 or 30 years. And, you know, the potential for really nasty stuff is very, very high. Don't forget, when we were talking earlier about the nuclear weapons, the Israelis have got nuclear weapons. They're not supposed to have them. Their weapons are illegal. And one simple solution for all of this is for somebody to inspect the Israeli weapons and say, right, you can't have those. That's what should have happened a long time ago.
Well, as Tulsi Gabbard, one of the things she also said is she told Congress that Iran is not rebuilding its nuclear program. So she is on the right side of history. She's making it absolutely clear. There is no evidence that the Iranians... So this is just something that's a fantasy in the mad dreams of Netanyahu.
Well, that's right. I mean, the Iranians, if the Iranians had got a nuclear weapon, they would be saying, yes, we've got it, now back off. They haven't got one, otherwise that's what they'd be doing. But of course, going forward, they may change their minds. And at that point, the Israelis say, well, we're not going to let them have a nuclear weapon, so we're entitled to bomb them with a nuclear attack.
One of the US F-35 fighters, these much, I think they're called the Lightning, the scamjet, I call them, extremely expensive. They can do quite a lot, they're vertical takeoff, etc. And one of them has been damaged by the Iranians. They've managed to hit it and it had a bit of a crash landing. It managed to bring the pilot down safely.
Well, what's happening is that the US and the Israelis are being very, very cagey about their casualties. And they're basically trying to pretend that they're not taking the kind of casualties they are.
And
the Iranian assessment says they're taking much larger casualties than they're admitting.
Well, we got Tulsi Gabbard saying her bit, and I think, I mean, it's her. I think I see her as an absolute heroine in all of this, that she's managing to stay on, and she's, if you read between the lines of what she's saying, she's making it absolutely clear that this is, the pretext for war is complete nonsense. At the same time, the Pentagon is saying, well, if you want us to carry on with this, we need another $200 billion, please.
Well, that's what they want. I mean, the people who make money out of the Pentagon, they just want the money spent. They're not really interested in war or strategy, are they?
So will the American Congress vote it for them?
Well, that's a big question, Tony. It's a big question. I think the Democrats are not necessarily...
Well, some of them are quick to criticise it, apparently.
Yes. Well, the thing, what they're hoping is that they're going to be able to whip up support in the US, and then they can go ahead and do whatever they want. But there isn't a lot they can do. They've just sent 2,500 Marines towards the Middle East. And when they get there, what are they going to do? The Iranian army is 500,000 strong. So 2,500 Marines ain't going to last
long.
Well,
they're talking about taking over this Karg Island, aren't they?
Ridiculous.
Which we were discussing last week. Why is that so ridiculous?
Well, they can attack Karg Island and blow it all up, so there's no oil coming from it. That's possible. But then, of course, the Iranians will then do exactly the same to Haifa and Abu Dhabi and Qatar and all of them. But if the Karg Island cannot be captured, what the idea is that the Marines would capture it, and therefore they wouldn't have to blow it up, and then they could get the oil themselves. But of course, the Iranians can just switch the tap off. And in any case, it's like Snake Island in the Black Sea, where the British Royal Marines and Navy were encouraging the Ukrainians to carry out all these amphibious landings. And of course, all that happens is you end up on an island with no cover, and you just get slaughtered. There's just no point to it.
Okay, so, yeah, so... What about the Straits of Hormuz? Come on, what's happening there? This is just completely closed. Some ships are being allowed to go through by the Iranians, and there's also talk about having a kind of massive toll, so that if you want to bring your ship through there, you've got to pay the Iranians.
Yeah, well, I think that's very sensible by the Iranians, isn't it? They could just close the whole thing off so that nobody can move anything in or out, and if they have to, then they might do that. But it makes a lot more sense to charge people to go through, and of course Britain being on the war, oil that's coming to Britain and gas that's coming to Britain, they say, well, that you can't take that through. Britain is part of the war, you are not going to get any oil or gas. China, on the other hand, they can, and of course that's the way to do it. Yeah, the people who are nice to the Iranians will get oil
and
gas. So
would it be simple that the British can bring their oil and gas through, but they have to pay more?
No, I think what they'll say is you need to get out of the war. Otherwise, you are a target, and your ships are a target. Your naval ships and your merchant ships are all targets, because you are fighting with us, and if you fight with us, we are going to kill you. That's what wars are about.
So we've had an extraordinary set of opinions from Donald Trump, haven't we, over the last couple of weeks about whether people should come and help him. Since the Straits of Hormuz were closed, he began with saying we're going to need NATO help. Then we had a little bit of a incident, and his Abraham Lincoln aircraft carrier goes sailing off at full speed in the opposite direction after having been hit by the Iranian missiles. So then he's saying, he starts off with we need help from NATO. He says we're not surprised then that NATO is not helping, and then he says we no longer need help from NATO.
Well, I mean, he's all over the place, isn't he?
Then he said we never needed help from NATO. Actually, then he swaps over looking at Asia, and he says we need Japan, Australia and Korea's help, because they'll come over because their oil price is rising, and if they come over and help us with their military vessels, etc., then we can help open the Straits of Hormuz. And it may be simply that he thought he was going to be able to, this was going to happen. He was conned into thinking that these various countries would come together in some sort of amazing coalition to reopen the Straits.
Well, astonishingly enough, he even suggested that the Chinese might join this little coalition. But of course, there's no motive for non-belligerent states to join such a coalition.
Is it that he's having the wool pulled over his eyes, do you think? That Donald Trump has actually got no real understanding of what military is and is not possible in geopolitics and the military, and he's just being conned by Kushner and people like this to think, oh, this is going to happen, that's going to happen, and it doesn't quite transpire the way that he thought it might?
Well, let's put it this way. He's not Alexander the Great. He's not a military strategist of any kind.
No, and he also says, we are the most powerful country in the world, even though he's had all these people turning him down. And he says, we don't need anyone's help now.
Well, it's like some teenager having a meltdown, isn't it? You know, go to your room.
We have 45,000 soldiers in Japan. We have we spend a lot of money on Japan, so... And we've had that kind of a relationship, so I'm not surprised that they would step up. We don't need much. We don't need anything. I mean, honestly, we don't need anything from Japan or from anyone else, but I think it's appropriate that people step up. In the case of Japan, I hear they get more than 90% of their oil through the Strait. Yes. So that's a big reason to step up. I mean, we've demolished, that country is supposed to demolished. The only thing is the Strait. It's very hard. You could take two people and they could drop little bombs in the water and they're holding things up. We don't want that to happen. But honestly, Japan, China, Europe, parts of Europe get a lot of their oil through the Strait. We get none, practically. We're less than 1%. We don't have to be any percent. We don't even... I think we do it just to be nice. But we... think of it. We don't use the Strait. We're defending the Strait for everybody else. And then in the case of NATO, they don't want to help us defend the Strait, and they're the ones that need it. But now they're getting much nicer because they're seeing my attitude. They're getting much nicer. But it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's too late. You know, UK wants to send aircraft carriers now. And I said, I want the aircraft carriers before the war. I don't want them after the war is won. They want to send me aircraft carriers after the war. There's practically nobody to shoot at them. You know, their missile count is down, Pete. Maybe you could discuss it by about 90-something percent. The drones are way down, and the factories are being demolished. Maybe.
Yes, sir. Our missiles being shot are down over 90% since the beginning. One-way attack drones down 90% since the beginning, which is a reflection of overwhelming firepower. But you mentioned the most important part, Mr. President. Their defense industrial base. If you can't make more of it in the future, then you have a limited supply. And so we're going after all of their defense contractors that make all of their exquisite weapons and ensuring that even if they wanted to rebuild more launchers or more missiles, they couldn't in the future. And that's a level of devastation for their military that they've never seen before.
So we have, in literally 2 weeks, we've demolished their Navy, their Air Force. All technology is gone. All communication is gone. And all of the leaders are gone. Other than that, they're doing quite well.
Well, I mean, if people tell themselves lies about a situation, they are not going to have a rational strategy. And this has been the problem all along. They believe their own propaganda.
Well, they're telling each other.
They're
lies,
high on their own supply. Anybody doesn't. You don't need to be a 4-star general to point out that the Straits of Hormuz is basically. If the Iranians close it, there's nothing you can do about it.
So he's saying we're
always
been
true.
We're only trying to defend the Straits of Hormuz and keep them open to be nice.
Well, what he's saying is that the rest of the world, you know, in the US, we've got our own oil supply from fracking and so on. So we don't need any of this. It's everybody else who needs this. So they ought to come to the strait and open the strait.
In the UK.
But of course, the only way to open the strait is to ask the Iranians nicely. And if you're nice to them, they might open the strait. There's no war mechanism for opening the strait. All that will happen if the aircraft carriers and all the rest of it go to the Strait of Hormuz is they'll all get sunk.
But haven't the Western military strategists, the Pentagon and everyone else, known this for decades?
They have, yes, and that's why nobody's done this.
But nobody told Donald Trump.
Well, Donald Trump really is, he's like a big child. You know, he doesn't really understand the consequences of his actions, and in actual fact, he shouldn't be in the position that he's in.
And what was he talking about? They can drop little bombs in the water.
Well, he's talking about mining the strait, and that's what everybody's saying. Well, if they mine the strait, they don't need to mine the strait. If they mine the strait, nobody can go through, and the Iranians are quite happy for some people to come through. People are being nice to them, like the Indians and the Chinese. You can have your oil. Why not?
And he's also saying that the UK could have sent its aircraft carriers over there long before the war started. Well, apparently Donald Trump didn't tell us anything about
well,
this war
right.
starting. So that would have, and they'd probably take at least 3 weeks or so, maybe longer, to get there in the first place. And anyway, you can only have one of these aircraft carriers out at any one time. The other one's got to be in dock being serviced. So, I mean, none of this really actually, you know, it's like when the rubber hits the road, Donald Trump just looks like a fool.
Well, he is a fool, isn't he? He's a very dangerous fool. If John F. Kennedy was in charge, none of this would be happening. But hey, he's dead.
Let's have a poem from Patrizia this week before the break. Ode a cause celebre. Thumper, dumper, trumper, skewed, a cannon loose, now, in full view, a tangled web, his strings pulled tight by Zionists. No risk of flight. A cause celebre, this emperor knows, the ups, the downs, the highs, the lows, where friends once found, now only foes. Bumptious Trump, with hubris led, with the mark of Epstein on his head. No rhymes nor reasons in his words, just ramblings, gamblings, très absurd. Of morals none, as limelight chases within the void of evil spaces. Orders swirl from high above, this dead man's shoes now fit like glove. Biddings done without salvation, a fallen star in declaration. High price, nice vice, the Don now knows. The world now sees him without clothes.
Fight the good fight.
a secret society do exist. Illuminati. Illuminati, a secret society do exist. Illuminati.
little buggy.
So that's Dr. John rounding up our musical break with The Quitter Never Wins. And so that's it. Keep going, Iran. Keep going, everybody, for the Palestinian cause and the anti-genocidalists and the anti-Epstein class types. Before that, we had a bit of Gary Clayle and New Sound System, Something Wrong with Human Nature. Well, that's maybe part of what's going on now, is this is being sort of purged from human nature. And then we had Teensy Power, which is join the Teensy Revolution, whatever that means. But anyway, some kind of revolution. That's Biss. It's a Scottish band from the 1990s, I think, or around about 1990s. And at the beginning, we heard, again, the wonderful choir of Guildford Cathedral, Fighting the Good Fight. So welcome back to the Bristol Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. I think maybe, I mean, it's not really being echoed massively in the mainstream press, but one of the most amazing stories of this week for me, being a Bilderberg watcher, because it's like the pyramid of power, the Bilderbergers, that's the way I see it, is the prosecution has just started of a guy called Etienne Davignon. Many people have not heard about him, for the murder of Patrice Lumumba. So can you just say, first of all, something, Martin, about who Lumumba was and why is his murder so significant?
Well, I mean, the Belgian Congo was originally a private company controlled by Prince Leopold of the Belgians, and of course they carried out massive human rights abuses, and the Belgian eventually got independence. Congo got independence from Belgium, and Patrice Lumumba was their first president. But of course, he was regarded by the West, the Americans and British in particular, as a threat, because at that stage they don't want nationalists running Africa, because they're going to basically, you know, they're going to, for example, nationalise mining concessions and things of that sort. So basically, they arranged to have him killed, and MI6 and the CIA were behind it.
I remember before she died, Daphne Park from MI6 confessed that the British had had a role in it, and MI6 had been involved in his murder too.
Well, that's right. And of course, Britain has been going around the world murdering people like that for a very long time. And of course, it creates chaos in the countries where we do these things. And then suddenly we've got all these people on look at all the refugees that are being created by the war in Iran right now. 3.5 million people have just been moved out of their
houses.
But
it's even more than that, isn't it? This is the idea that the colonial powers are retreating from Africa after World War II was just a lie. When the people wanted their people, like Lumumba, in charge, I mean, he was a smart guy, wasn't he? He was very smart.
Yes, well, obviously, he never got a chance to prove what he may or may not have done. But beforehand,
he managed to get... Yes. Yeah, I mean, he was
the leader of the independence movement, and he was quite a well-educated civil servant type. But, of course, they put Mobutu Sese Seko in power, who was just a pro-Western thug.
And this is what happened. He
basically just looted the whole country for years.
Yeah, like is going on right now in Venezuela.
Well, in Venezuela, you've got a revolutionary movement which has been compromised.
Yeah, but he's got the president has been taken out, and the vice president is going along with all the Americans want.
Yes, well, I mean, that's because it's a different situation than the one in the Congo.
I think it's a very similar thing.
Imperialism is the thing that's the same in all these situations. The imperial powers do not want anybody doing what they don't want.
Somebody who's elected by the people in that country, represent that country, who is then removed by fair means or foul, and some puppet is replacing them.
Well, that's the way Western imperialism has worked for hundreds of years, and it hasn't stopped. They're still doing it. Belgium. It's not something that used to happen. It's something that's ongoing policy.
So Etienne Davignon was the chairman of Bilderberg when I first started covering these Bilderberg meetings back in 2000. I remember I was with Chris Bolin from Spotlight, I think it was now called the American Free Press. He's also one of the people who's written the best books on 9/11. I think it's called Solving 9/11. If you really want a proper book on the September the 11th attacks, Chris is your man. And he was there as a photographer at that 2000 meeting in Belgium. It was in Belgium, yeah, Jean Val. We managed to get one of the major national newspapers down on the Saturday, and it was all over the papers and all over Belgium the next day, because they'd been lying to the press saying it was a croquet tournament. And I suppose the point is, Davignon, I remember seeing him, he was fiddling with his car. He's the Bilderberg chairman. He had getting something out of his car in the car park, and Chris called over to him, and as he turned around, of course, snap, 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 and he got loads of great pictures of Davignon. But anyway, Etienne Davignon is to face charges over the murder of Congo's first premier. I'll put the full article from the FT up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Etienne Davignon, 93 years old, is the only surviving former official who's now accused in connection to Patrice Lumumba's death. He served as a diplomat and European commissioner. He will now have to face trial regarding his involvement, possible involvement, alleged involvement in the murder of Patrice Lumumba. He is the first Prime Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo after it gained independence from Belgium in 1960, following 75 years of brutal colonial rule. He was murdered in Katanga on January the 17th, 1961, an act that occurred with the support of the Belgian government, according to the findings of a parliamentary commission in 2001. In 2011, Lumumba's son filed a criminal complaint against 10 Belgian nationals, accusing them of complicity, 2011, in his father's murder. Other family members later joined the claim. The assassination of Congo's first democratically elected prime minister was a defining moment of the Cold War. It cemented Western influence over Congo and contributed, according to historians, to preventing the vast nation at the heart of Africa from emerging as an independent country in the years afterwards. In martyrdom, Lumumba became one of the most enduring symbols of Africa's struggle against colonial rule. So the Belgian Federal Prosecutor's Office, it says, Davignon now faces charges for participation in war crimes related to the unlawful detention and transfer of a person protected by the Geneva Conventions for having deprived prisoners of war and an occupied population of the right to a fair and impartial trial, and humiliating and degrading treatment against Lumumba. So anyway, the full article is there. But this is an interesting little thing, isn't it? So if you're assassinating Patrice Lumumba in 1961, just as this African nation gets its freedom from colonial rule, what you're really doing is ushering in the age of neo-colonialism.
Well, that's right. And of course, Congo has had a very unfortunate history since then, with interventions by Rwanda and so on. And of course, this has been the way.
It's not unfortunate, is it? This is actually the West.
Unfortunate for them.
It's the West. It's the West still being a colonial power, but by proxy, by having these proxy leaders.
Well, of course, in Latin America, they're all supposedly independent states, but the military take power in Chile and in Argentina and other places, and they basically serve the interests of the United States, and they kill loads of people. The Argentinians junta killed maybe 30,000 people. Horribly killed them as well. They didn't just kill them, they tortured them to death. And that was US imperialism.
Well,
it wasn't the Argentinians.
The reason I mention in relation to what's happening now with Iran is this whole thing of assassination is quite important, isn't it? I mean, if you go back to the execution guy in the IRA, is it Tony Scapaticci? Yeah. So what happens is you begin to infiltrate an organization. Say you happen to be MI6, the Mossad or whatever, or the Belgian government or the Belgian mining interests trying to infiltrate the Congo, or maybe the American Southcom trying to control and infiltrate Venezuela. What happens is you start to assassinate people at the top, and then your people start to move towards positions of power as you do these assassinations. So this may be also what's been going on with Hamas in Gaza, and also of course in Iran, that maybe agents are moving towards the top of the power in Iran as people above them are being assassinated.
Well, I mean, it's a very, very murky world where this stuff is going on, but it's quite clear that murder and assassination, decapitation strikes are the mood of the moment. It's got not.
Well, it's what I'm saying is it's 1961. It's yes, going on back then.
Well, that's right. But I mean, it's always been going on, but there's been a huge increase in it. I mean, you know, they were really pleased that they got Ali Khamenei and all of the top military people because they're all in the same room discussing the so-called peace plan. And that is just abhorrent, really, if you think about it. Who is going to try and make peace in a world where people sit down and try to agree something, and then somebody comes along and kills you? In that case, there's no point talking, is there? None whatsoever.
So this week I spoke to Oliver Tickell, who's the former editor of the Ecologist magazine as a newspaper, and it was also online. And I asked him about what he made of this, because he was very interested in all these links between energy industries and geopolitics. Do you want to just say something about that, Martin? They are most definitely intertwined, aren't they, the two?
That's right. I mean, our civilization, despite attempts to move in a sort of renewable direction, interestingly enough, I've just read that China has actually got to the stage where they're generating half of their electricity from non-fossil fuel sources.
Yeah, more than
sources.
Half. Yeah, I talked to him about that as well, actually. So anyway, let's let Oliver take it away, because this is what I really wanted to ask him about. You know, what is going on, particularly with the Straits of Hormuz and the energy prices. Is there going to be a toll charged? He also had quite a lot to say about what's happening up at RAF Fairford, and we've got another guest talking about that in a minute.
I think that actually we're experiencing quite a big pushback. And I mean, Europe has pushed back massively just in terms of denouncing this entire criminal enterprise, which is Trump's war on Iran, Trump's war, and of course Israel's war, and the steadfast refusal of other NATO countries to have anything to do with it, Europe's collective refusal to get involved. That is actually a massive pushback. I mean, it is unprecedented. But then Trump's behavior has also been unprecedented, to go into this war with no discussion with allies and sending out all kinds of weird messages, whether about Greenland or invading Canada, or and saying that he didn't want any help from these European countries anyway because they're useless, and then begging them to get involved, and then suddenly finding, no, surprise, surprise, they didn't want to get involved. And I just think that there is a sort of mood of rebellion, whether it's Russia saying, sod it, we are going to send that fuel to Cuba because it's the right thing to do, or whether it's the Europeans saying, we are not joining your war, Mr. Trump. And a very interesting thing there that I just heard today from an impeccable source is that the Europeans are actually going to be doing a deal with Iran to ship out liquefied natural gas and oil from Iranian ports to Europe, paying a fee, and I imagine it won't be a small fee, but paying a fee for safe passage through the Straits of Hormuz, and all sanctions lifted. And that Europe will actually be taking direct delivery of gas and oil from Iran through the Straits of Hormuz. And that this is all worked out with Lloyd's insurers. And this is again a complete break with the past in Europe, actually acting in its own self-interest rather than just getting led by the nose into America, into conflicts and disputes and other kinds of illegal sanctions and other activities, which don't serve them at all.
So are you talking about at an EU level or independently the nation states of Europe?
Well, there was a statement put out, which I just saw on Telegram, by a number of European countries, which include Britain and Germany and the Netherlands, and I can't remember the rest, but a good consortium of European countries. And this I think relates to this deal that I mentioned. The actual deal itself is secret and not public, but it kind of opens the way to that, talking about finding ways of getting the Straits of Hormuz open to traffic and keeping Europe supplied. So I think that actually this also fits. And then there was another thing today on Al Jazeera, which was saying that Trump was actually open to lifting sanctions on Iran for the purpose of getting oil and gas out. So this is really rather a dramatic change. Europe standing up for himself, suddenly talk of lifting sanctions on Iran, of America lifting sanctions on
Iran. Well, this is incredible, particularly since they are actually in the process of using RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire to directly bomb Iran from the UK using their B-1 and B-52 bombers. They can't overfly Europe. They have to go down the Atlantic coast right through the Strait of Gibraltar, flying over the top of that and down the Mediterranean to get there. But it's extraordinary if the Americans are thinking about lifting sanctions on Iran at the same time as bombing them.
Yes, yes. I mean, it's all getting very topsy-turvy. By the way, I've got my own theory about one reason why Starmer is letting those flights go out of RAF Fairford, and that is that he thinks that if he told America that not to, and he didn't want them to, they might just do it anyway. And then what? What are we going to do if Britain forbids America to bomb Iran out of RAF Fairford and they just do it anyway?
Because they have been doing that, haven't they? Pretty much what they want at their United States Air Force bases like Marham, like Laken Heath, and Mildenhall in Norfolk, they are bringing in nuclear bombs, which obviously make Britain very much a target. I mean, it almost like it's a throwback to the
90s. They make Britain a target, and they also put, perhaps not us, but certainly other European countries hosting American nuclear bombs are actually in breach of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
Oh, yeah, but this is the rule book is being torn up left, right and centre.
The various rule books are being torn up. And it's definitely getting interesting in terms of what's happening. And I heard another interesting thing today, which was a video by Chris Hedges with Max Blumenthal, which is available on YouTube, about all the stratagems pulled by Israel to get Trump into this war. And apparently one thing that's going on right at this very moment in time is that he doesn't believe the reports, even when he sees the videos of the massive damage being done by Iranian strikes on American bases and radar systems and Tel Aviv. And really, there is quite a large scale of destruction. Trump is being shown these videos and he's just saying, I don't believe it. You know, these are AI generated. Now, there is a lot of AI generated stuff out there, but these are actually videos being put out by major news organizations, which are definitely not AI generated stuff. And not Trump that. Just isn't believing it. He's living in this sort of delusional world in which he thinks that America is winning.
So is that possible, that Trump is just getting fed lots and lots of nonsense, and when he sees something he doesn't want to see, he says, I don't believe that, it's AI?
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, if you're going to have a war, you've got to actually have a pretty good assessment of what's actually happening, if you're going to actually fight one and win it. But Trump, basically, is a fantasist. So he just says what he wants to say. I mean, look at the way he uses statistics, you know. We've got 90% plus. Except, how do you know that? Well, I just know. And what
we haven't eliminated the entire country, obliterated.
That's right. Well, so he just comes out with stuff which is patently, childishly wrong, and that's clearly what, the way his mind works.
I think it's. I rather like what Morandi was saying about the emperor seems to have no clothes. He's doing all this right in front of the world's public.
Well, he is. And, you know, I suppose the joke is that if they were any more intelligent, they'd be dangerous. The fact that they are so stupid is, of course, a positive
thing.
Makes
it far more dangerous, well, actually,
makes them more dangerous in one way.
They're easier to con, aren't they? So Kushner and the rest of them will be whispering things in his ears, they're about to assassinate you, Mr. President.
All that stuff about how the Iranians were trying to assassinate him is just a load of flim-flam. That's not, you know, they've just made that up out of whole cloth. I don't know, there's a shred of evidence.
Okay, so what about what Oliver's saying there about the European individual nations, not the EU, this is, negotiating with Iran separately to open the Straits of Hormuz to their tankers and talking to Lloyd's insurers about it all, saying, actually, look, this doesn't make any sense, let's just come to an agreement with them.
Well, I think the Iranians are open to discussing that with individual countries in Europe, but they're not going to discuss it with us because we're bombing them. Spain, yes.
Well, apparently they may. They may do. Britain would have to pay a bit of a higher toll.
No, Britain would have to stop allowing its bases to be used.
Well, this brings us
Iran.
On to the next point, doesn't it? Oliver's saying that actually the British are not in the position to say to the United States that you can't use Fairford because there would have to be some sort of military confrontation on the ground there. The British RAF or even possibly special forces might have to go in and tell the Americans to stop loading the bombs up and go home.
Yes, well, I mean, the question is, why have we got any US bases in Europe is starting to come into the agenda, isn't it? Why are they here at all?
Do you think he's right, though, when he says that that's the reason that we were allowing them to do it? It's because we actually don't dare to tell them no.
Well, that's pretty much the long and the short of it. What you could do, of course, is you say, we're telling you not to do it, and if you carry on doing it, we're going to cut off your electricity and we're going to cut off your water.
I suppose you could do things like that, couldn't you? They've got their own generators, though, Martin, and plenty of diesel there.
Yeah. Okay, well, the Iranians might accept that. Okay, they're flying diesel in from the US for these planes, but you are definitely doing the right thing by trying to close them down, so maybe we will let your royal three.
You're right. So, fascinating. In a way, Britain is actually almost like being treated like a Gulf state here, in terms, although we're much, much further away and better protected from Iranian missiles of all different sorts. Britain is providing a place for America to do these war crimes against Iran.
It is. And I think ultimately, in my lifetime, and I'm 66, I want to see US bases out of this country. They shouldn't be there at all. They should never have been there.
I spoke this week to... We're going to hear a little bit more from Oliver Tickell in a minute, but I did speak this week to Nigel Day from the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament, because tomorrow at between 12:30 and 1:30 at RAF Fairford, they're going to be having a fairly low-key reading of the names of the dead, of all of the kids that were killed on the first day of the bombing in Tehran in this... primary school, almost all girls, I think, and a few teachers were killed as well, but they're going to be reading their names out outside the gates of RAF Fairford tomorrow. Or should we now call it USAF Fairford, Martin?
Well, yes, that makes sense. Can I just mention there is a protest in Bristol tomorrow at 1 p.m. in Broadmead?
Anyway, it says I've listened to Nigel Day from CND, where he explains that actually there's much of the news that's coming out of there is being supplied by these plane spotters with amazing telephoto lenses.
Yeah, I mean, the plane spotters have always been there. I mean, I remember from the first Gulf War, B-52 bombers there being loaded up with bombs. We watched them wheel them across from the bomb store the other side of the road. They wheeled them across. They loaded the planes up. And quite a few local people were there showing their children these lovely planes taking off. And I did think at the time, I was quite shocked, thinking, do you know what those bombs are going to do in a couple of hours? And people still go there. Lots of spotters do, plane spotters. It's one of the big places for them to gather and take pictures. Yeah. And they're not necessarily supporting it, but they are enthusiastic about aircraft. So I guess they're watching the bombers taking off, not really... worrying too much about what they're doing, where they're going.
Well, what's your thoughts about, this is quite clearly an illegal war under the UN Charter. There's been no It's not a defensive action, which it has to be. And there's also been no vote at the Security Council or in the UK Parliament or in the US Senate or Congress to approve it. I mean, so effectively what we're watching when we're watching those bombs being loaded up, those planes landing and taking off, the bombers you're talking about, is potentially war crimes.
I agree. Yes, it is. And they're doing, it's an illegal war, and they are using our F, you know, the F, although it is an American, it is in name RAF Fairford, but in fact, it's really an American air base. We don't have any personnel there. Maybe one or two liaison people. Basically, it's an American plane and they're illegally bombing Iran. Yes.
So when it was the Iraq war, there were quite a lot of protests up there at Fairford. Weapons inspectors, I think it was the, because they were really making a parody of the apparent weapons inspectors that had been sent over to Iraq. They were saying, well, what about having weapons inspectors from Britain in Fairford?
Yeah, they probably did it there. They certainly have done it at Aldermaston Atomic Weapons Establishment and Burfield Atomic Weapons Establishment. My partner was dressed by Greenpeace as a weapons inspector and went to Aldermaston. So that's another thing, yeah, we've done over the years, yes.
What exactly has been going on up at Fairford over the last few weeks and what's planned? Because I know there is actually a traditional spot there where the peace camps have been in the past anyway.
The peace camp was round on one edge of it. They blocked that particular road off because you can get quite near where the planes are parked. So there's no peace camp there this time, and where it was has been blocked off by the roads have been closed. I guess they let the people who live up that way go through. But anyway, and so most of the spotters are on the road between Welford and Kempsford. It's a long thing. You get a good view of the runway landings and takeoffs. So most spotters gather there. It's a traditional place for spotters to be there. And that's where a lot of the films and Zoom things are coming from.
What about peace gatherings then?
I don't know of that at all. We have gone and protested there a number of times last year and this year. And the reason we're doing that is partly because what is happening at the moment, of course. And before this happened, we were protesting because the future of Fairford is interesting. They spent a lot of money on the place. At the moment, they have U-2 spy planes flying off, gathering intelligence. And the potential is that they will replace those as they retire with drones, large drones, very large drones. And that will be the future of Fairford. They will have, the U-2s will be replaced by drones. So we have protested about that there. That they have been given a particular, the unique at the moment, the only one at the moment, a kind of pathway out of Fairford for the future over to the North Sea. Already some complaints saying that could interfere with landings at Birmingham Airport. So this is the first time these drones have been allowed to fly in our space. They're not there yet, but that's the potential of the future. So it's an important base, sits there quietly, but the future will be drones. So this is the future of the place.
Now, I know there's going to be a small gathering this weekend on Saturday. I think it's 12:30 to 1:30, roughly, at Fairford. But I know you're also planning something a bit bigger for a few weeks' time.
Yes. We don't want a huge gathering this Saturday necessarily. There are big other gatherings in London and so on that people are going to. We are going there just to maintain our presence there, and we want to read out the names of the dead. But in the next one, possibly will be 11th of April. Whether this is all going on then, I don't know. But anyway, 11th of April, possibly a larger gathering at Fairford. But we will send out details nearer the time when we see what the situation is.
Nigel Day there from CND speaking to me about what's happening up at Fairford. Is a longer version, as with Oliver Tickell, a longer version of the interview we put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk and on Radio 4 All later on. He's describing, Martin, a long history really of Fairford. And he's also, I mean, do you think maybe if the Americans annoy the British by using the base when we don't want them to, that there may be some question over whether we will be happy about them flying these drones out of Fairford in the years to come?
Well, obviously, as Oliver Tickell pointed out, if they decide that they're not going to take any notice, if Britain, first of all, has to say, we don't want you to do this, which we haven't done, but if we did say that, they may say, well, we don't care, we're going to do it anyway. And, of course, that's the reality. In actual fact, British foreign policy is decided in Washington, and we don't really have much of a say in it. We never had.
So, anyway, back to Oliver Tickell now, another excerpt from the interview with him about what's going on with Iran. Just to make it absolutely clear, the RAF Fairford in Gloucestershire is a massive runway where these American bombers are coming. There are also massive American transport planes full of bombs are coming there, and so they're being used to load up these aircraft. I think it's pretty clear that these particular strikes, Martin, in Iran, are the attempt is from Fairford to be bombing the infrastructure, the military infrastructure, much of it buried and hidden in Iran, to stop them producing their ballistic missiles, etc.
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, the problem is that they can't find any useful military targets because they're all basically underground. So in actual fact...
They may have intelligence about where they are.
Well, yes, but the thing is, even if you know where they are, you can't necessarily drop a bomb on a tunnel, as the Hamas have proved. And, of course, the Israelis have definitely gone in for smashing up the infrastructure. So they bombed the oil refinery near Tehran, which caused a huge pollution.
So there's always this kind of bit of competition, isn't there, between military targets and civilian targets? I mean, obviously, the main hub for servicing cars is not a military target.
Well,
what they can go for. They're
yes,
going
well,
for
in Lebanon,
palaces where, as well.
In Lebanon, where the Israelis are pursuing what they call the Dahelia Doctrine. Dahelia is the southern suburb of Beirut, and the Dahelia Doctrine is that if Hezbollah carry on fighting us, we are going to kill everybody in that suburb. We're going to kill everybody, and of course that is the Israeli philosophy. They are basically treating the Iranian population as a target, because they basically their goal isn't even regime change; it's just to create chaos so that Iran can no longer threaten Israel's hegemony.
Pete Hegseth is, I think, a desperate man, and he's desperate because he knows that this whole thing, this whole war that he's so much part of, has been spinning completely out of control. And it's almost like, you know, he's desperate for the Messiah to turn up and end times to happen. For the apocalypse to take place, because it's a way out for him. It's a way out. Because he is now in a very bad place. And if he was pulled up on a cloud and sucked up into heaven, well, you know, that would solve his problems, wouldn't it? But I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, it's also not going to help him actually win. In fact, it seems as if they've set out on this course, which is unwinnable without a plan.
With no plan at all. And this is one of the very interesting things about, you know, how this war was engineered to take place and engineered by Israel to take place. And according to Max Blumenthal, the answer is that Israel has been working on Trump for a very long time. So you can go right the way back to the assassination of Soleimani, the architect of Iranian resistance, who actually created the essential concepts behind what is happening now. And so Israel sold Trump on this idea of targeted assassinations of key figures. But this was only really a stratagem to get Trump sucked in, because once they had him sucked in doing that, They were saying, oh, you do realize, of course, that you will now be an assassination target from the IGRC. He's saying, what? He said, oh, yes. I mean, you've been assassinating their chaps, and so now they're going to be out to assassinate you. But don't worry, you did the right thing. It was in a noble cause. And so Trump is suddenly paranoid that he's going to get assassinated. So what's his response? Assassinate more people. Assassinate the Ayatollah Khamenei. But of course, the more he gets led down this path of assassination by Israel to eliminate threats and enemies, the more he actually becomes a target. So this is one of the stratagems that they use to get him completely sucked into this war and this whole cause.
Well, okay, so what about your crystal ball gazing? Where do you think this is heading? Because I'm starting to think maybe we should be stockpiling food, we should be stockpiling fuel, this sort of thing. Maybe the preppers were right.
Well, we do not depend on the Straits of Hormuz for our food supply, but there are people who do. So for those people who depend on the Straits of Hormuz for their food supply, they probably do want to be stocking food. As far as Britain's concerned, I mean, that isn't really happening. But certainly energy prices are rising a lot. Fortunately for us in Britain, we are covered by these energy price guarantees on gas and electricity, and it may be that all of these high prices will actually have to be paid by the power companies, the energy companies, without feeding through to consumers, and that would be good. But there are still problems with things like ammonia for fertilizer, which is generally produced from natural gas, and much of it is produced in places like Qatar. And so there will be problems with fertilizer supply, energy generally, production of plastics, which are key to our economies in many ways. I mean, everything comes wrapped in plastic. A lot of people wish it didn't, you know, but it is very useful stuff, although it has its big downsides. So I think that there are going to be huge supply chain shocks. Here in Britain, I don't think we're going to be running out of anything, but it will have a huge economic impact, and inflation will definitely get another big push, like it did with the previous energy crisis, when Europe cut itself off voluntarily from cheap Russian energy, blaming it on Russia, although in fact it was an entirely self-inflicted wound. So yes, economic shocks for sure, affordability crisis getting worse. One other thing I've noticed here in Britain is that suddenly Labour is actually starting to sound as if it wants Labour policies. And I put this down to the Green election victory in Birmingham, which has definitely given the Labour Party massive pause for thought because of being outflanked on the left and taking a really thumping election defeat. And they are suddenly, I think, thinking, hang on, we have to get our own voters or people who have been our voters to turn out and vote for us. We have to follow the policies that we were elected on. Now, why did it take them so long? I don't know. But suddenly they have tweaked. Only today they were talking about rejoining the EU. Now, I'm not sure about that myself, but it is something that most Labour voters actually do want.
So maybe the Labour Party suddenly finding its mojo after a couple of years of being in office, Martin.
Yeah, it'll be pressure from the backbenchers, which will be pushing the government in the right direction, if they go in the right direction.
And is he right about pressure from the Greens, well?
Yes, of course. Well, what the Greens have done is they've shown people in core Labour constituencies that they can vote Green And, you know, the government, you know, that isn't going to let in the other side necessarily. And at that point, the Labour Party is toast, potentially. I mean, in many European countries, the mainstream Labour parties have just been completely taken apart by forces to their left. By, you know, it's standard procedure in countries like Spain. The left wing under Yolanda Díaz, Sanchez is absolutely dependent on him. So you could easily see an election happening where the Labour Party would need green votes to form a government. And at that point, you know, it all starts to get a bit interesting, doesn't it?
Yeah, the Labour Party, Ed Miliband, is not the most favourite person in the world. The failed leader of the Labour Party has been brought back in to oversee the disastrous energy policies. What makes up the cost of a litre of petrol in Britain? Well, 17% of it is VAT. 38% of it is fuel duty. Then there's also delivery costs around about only about 1%. There's about 6% or 5% the retailers get, and only a third of what you're paying for the fuel is actually anything to do with the original price that the petrol companies are paying from the oil. So this is worth remembering, isn't it? So when the fuel goes up, say 25 pence a litre, that's really, I mean, if it's this is of 33, this is as a proportion of only one third. So what they're doing is the fuel companies are actually putting up massively more than they should be. They're making profit out of this, and just because of what people are seeing in the news, people are prepared to stomach it, and the government too.
Well, we shouldn't have privatised energy companies, because their motives are that it doesn't matter if there's a high price as long as we get the profit. And that's one of the reasons why you shouldn't run a key industry like that with the private sector focus.
So what's, I mean, it's around about 50 pence a litre what we're paying for the actual fuel. And so when it goes up 25 pence a litre, that's a 50% increase.
Yeah, can I just pick up on
that's
one point?
That's not the increase in the oil prices is not 50%.
No, but when you say one third of the price at the moment is made up by the oil price at the moment at $110, but if it goes up to $250, it won't be just 30% of the price. The real problem is in the spot markets. Yeah, it's the futures markets for oil and gas which are going to create the problems. And of course this will filter through as stagflation at best, recession quite possibly, and even depression. And of course if the oil infrastructure in the Gulf is really smashed up, you won't be able to get it back up and running for at least 20 years.
I seem to remember that Rachel Reeves is having real problems actually getting any economic growth. Now this is designed, it seems to me, to force us into negative growth and to do massive increases to inflation, things like food. I mean, this is what happens when fuel prices go up. Yes. Everything goes up. Everything. Yes.
So in other words, what we may need to do is have a crash government program to nationalise the whole of industry. And of course, that's what happened during COVID. The government actually took over the economy, World War II as well.
The only thing that might go down in price is housing, because people can't actually afford the housing anymore. And so the market price will possibly start going downwards.
Well, and of course, as I said earlier, that will mess up the real estate market for shops and offices and so on. But I mean, there is no real solution to the crisis of capitalism than socialism. Yeah, more capitalism is not going to solve the
economy. Well, we can actually agree for a change on that. Definitely there should be renational. I mean, the water business, the water industry, I mean, they're complaining again about that today, saying, oh, it's terrible. There's more in the news about water pollution. I mean, the obvious thing to do is just to kick out these private equity firms and to take it over. But it seems the government doesn't have the courage to do that, just as they don't have the courage to say to the Americans, no, you can't use Fairford.
Well, that's right. I mean, they're a managerial right-wing Labour government, and they thought what we're going to do is we're going to knock off the edges of the Tory austerity policies. That'll make people a bit happier. But we're basically going to manage the same deregulated economy that we've inherited from Thatcher and Blair. But of course, ultimately, the solution to this capitalist crisis, which is what it is socialist planning. And of course, the Chinese are forging ahead with their 15th five-year plan. Have we got a five-year plan? Of course we haven't.
I don't think we have. I don't think we have anything, no. So where it's really being successful on one part of the world is China.
Well, that's right. Obviously, they've got dangers in this situation as well. I mean, everybody's connected to everybody else, and it's, you know, they will be rocked by these changes as much as. But we are incredibly vulnerable because we've got one of the highest traded open economies in the world. In other words, we export quite a bit and we import quite a bit. You know, our economy is
more vulnerable than most to international trade.
That's right. Probably. I mean, and of course, it's very financialized as well. So ultimately, you could see a situation where, you know, nothing much works in Britain at all because it's just not viable anymore. Now, does that mean we're all going to starve?
Everything becomes too expensive and grinds to a halt. Well, this is why we had that whole no farmers, no food campaign last year when the Labour government tried to trick the farmers and get rid of them so that the private equity firms could take over big chunks of British land. Another story, by the way, this week is that the land registry, they have now decided that they want to open up the land registry, Martin, so that it's free and easily available, who owns which piece of land where, and that of course means individual houses. So if you go onto the land registry website now, you can find out who owns a piece of it. You have to pay a few pounds, but they're going to say that all that information should be public knowledge.
Well, I mean, in the free market textbook, we're supposed to have perfect information so that we can make rational decisions about what we want to buy. So in that case, we need to know who owns what. And we need to know how much people are paying in tax. In Scandinavia, like Norway, everybody's tax returns are online. I could look up your tax return, so I know exactly how much you're being paid. And of course, that leads to people.
Nothing, yeah.
Well, but I mean, the point is, it leads to people being quite blasé about raising taxes on the wealthy. They look at how much money people have actually got, and they say, "Well, we can raise some money there, so let's raise some money on them." Whereas what they do in this country is all of these tax affairs are supposedly secret, you know. What does, you know, you don't like to ask people what they earn.
It's been banned, Tony Blair, for example.
So, no, but the point is, in a free market textbook, you need to know how much people earn.
I suppose, in a way,
otherwise you can't make rational decisions.
It's quite important for somebody like Blair to be able to hide his wealth, so he's scared. He can be easily told, well, look, if you don't do X, Y, and Z, we will have to let everyone know how much you earn. You know, there's all sorts of ways you can bribe and bully somebody if they're afraid to actually be the person that they are in public.
Well, I mean, one of the things that I would recommend is that everybody who has a British passport and is a British citizen has to pay taxes on all of their earnings anywhere where they've earned them. And if they don't want to do that and they want to move out of the country, they can, but we're going to take your passport off you, and that means you won't be able to come. You might be able to visit, but you won't be able to live here. This is the sort of thing that used to happen in Athens quite a lot. Somebody who was annoying everybody, they used to have what they called ostracism, the ostraca, which was a broken bit of pottery, and they just voted to banish people, because, you know, you're getting too big for your boots, matey, you need to go, and they were told to just get out of the country.
So what do you make of the, whether or not the Epstein files and the Epstein class is really related? The Iranians are making a big thing of this. Mohammed Randi, whether the whole Epstein file release, the Ghislaine Maxwell operation to blackmail people and traffic kids, whether that's really related to this war at all, or is that just pure speculation?
Well, I mean, of course it's related. It's one aspect of what's going on. The Israelis have planned for this war for many, many years, and one of the ways they plan for doing it is by making sure that Epstein had got all these different people compromised.
But he's also got people operating his estate. Even though he's dead, Jeffrey Epstein has these two guys operating his estate. The BBC and various other people, the Daily Mail, etc., have been revealing this. Richard Kahn, that's K-A-H-N, and Darren Indyke, Indyke, they are his executors, and the pair apparently received millions in fees and loans from Epstein, paid off survivors, and even facilitated coerced marriages for women trafficked from abroad to allow them to stay in the US, according to the documents filed in court. The one lawsuit alleges that nobody except Ghislaine Maxwell was as essential and central to Epstein's operation as Indyk and Khan. So these two guys are still sort of circulating, controlling all of Jeffrey Epstein's estate. The headline is, Jeffrey Epstein had two key aides. Why do they still control his money and his secrets?
Well, because what's happened with this limited hangout of what we've been told the FBI's files are, they are basically, they can throw fairly low-level people, say Mandelson, into the wood chipper. But that means fairly high-level people like Trump. You saw what happened to Mandelson? That could happen to you. So they're using, the blackmail is actually very, you know, by holding back some of the files, you get some people given a very hard time, and the ones that, the files that, which have not been revealed, they've still got those to hang over people. So in other words, the whole operation is still running. Of course it is.
So anyway, on the economic fallout from Trump and Netanyahu's Iran war, the crazy war, the illegal war, the war with no plan, I think maybe we should just call it, is that there is a big shortage of diesel oil. So this is one of the reasons why we've had the government this week announcing they're subsidising the fuel oil that's going to people's homes to heat them, particularly Northern Ireland. A lot of people are reliant on this fuel oil, which has massively ballooned in price. But there's another reason why I think why diesel is going up at the forecourts, and that's because it's actually far more calorifically efficient than petrol. So you actually get more bangs for your buck in terms of motive power from diesel than you do from petrol. And so the idea, I suppose, is to me, you know, whatever calories are in there, that both of them will, you'll get, you know, well, I don't know, 20 pence per calorie or something from either petrol or diesel. It's always actually been more fuel efficient. And particularly with big lorries, it's much more fuel efficient. But even when you start getting really big diesel engines, diesel is way, way, way more efficient than almost any other fuel. And that's why, Martin, we've had this massive problem with the lack of this fuel for ships. Anyway, the governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, popped his head up above the parapet briefly yesterday, and he was asked about, oh, they're not going to be increasing or reducing interest rates, they're going to keep them steady. But what was his thoughts about the future for the British economy with no oil coming through the Straits of Hormuz?
The average price of a litre of unleaded petrol, that's calculated by the RAC, it's risen by 0.7 pence today. It's up 8% since the start of the war. If you drive a petrol car, you've probably noticed, in fact, much more so if it's diesel, up 15% since the beginning of the war. Those are just signs of how international events, beyond really the control of British people, the British government, come home to affect the daily lives of citizens here. And today has perhaps felt like one where the risks to the UK economy have crystallised, most notably with the Bank of England making its regular decision on interest rates, which was to do nothing for now, hold them at 3.75%, but be ready to raise them if necessary, as inflation will probably be about a percentage point higher than the bank had been thinking later this year. Now, in fact, traders are betting the bank will raise UK interest rates perhaps twice this year to combat the inflationary hit from the crisis in the Middle East, fully pricing in a quarter point rise in the rate to 4% by June. In fact, the BBC's economics editor, Faisal Islam, has been talking to the governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, and put that point to him.
That's getting ahead of where the committee is, frankly. The committee was very clear, and it was obviously a unanimous vote this time, actually, that the right thing to do was to hold. The right thing to do is to pause, to take a very close, you know, keep a very close watch on what's going on. But also, this is a very volatile situation. I think by the next time we meet, which will be, you know, our next decision is at the end of April, you know, a lot will have happened. And I can't predict what, I can't possibly, none of us can predict what it will be. But it is a very volatile situation. So I would caution, really, against getting ahead of that position, which is we held this time.
So 3.75, it is markets thinking it's going to go up. Governor saying, well, it's all very volatile. I think we can agree it's all very volatile. And it's not just the UK reflecting on what is going to hit all over the world. The conversations are the same. The ECB held interest rates, the European Central Bank today as well. And then we had a warning from the World Trade Organization that the war could lead to a small reduction, just a half point reduction, in global goods trade this year. Let's talk through some of this with Stephanie Flanders, head of economics and politics at Bloomberg. Stephanie, how bad are you and colleagues at Bloomberg thinking all of this is? What's it, what it's adding up to?
I think that, I mean, you saw, crystallize was the right word. We saw some of the potential risks for central banks, for interest rates, for inflation in those forecasts from the Bank of England today. You know, instead of inflation falling to target as they were expecting, it's probably going to be staying well above for the rest of the year. Instead of looking potentially at more interest rate cuts this year, the rates are going to stay where they are or even go up. Some debate about how much they go up. I think the sort of bottom line is a few weeks ago when this conflict started, certainly colleagues of mine were sort of saying we were still in a mode where this could be very short. And if it's very short, the impact on the global economy could also be very short lived or, you know, almost non-existent. But people were saying, for example, with the Strait of Hormuz that we all know about and its importance now, you know, that needed to reopen within a week. Of course, we've gone past that now. And I think the crucial thing that's happened in the last few days is people have realized with these attacks, particularly on gas facilities and other bits of infrastructure, there's no going back now. I mean, there's no going back to that quick, sharp shock scenario. So we're either looking at a long, drawn out, low intensity conflict or something worse. And both of those have got big consequences for the global economy.
Okay, so yes, no short shot shot, Martin. She's using interesting language there, it seems to me, that she's sort of hinting that things could get far, far worse than they already are.
Well, that's right. And of course, they're doing their very best behind the scenes to keep stock markets up, to keep confidence up. And they're spinning a line that this is going to be ending soon. And of course, a lot of people want to believe that because the alternative is selling everything. And then, of course, everything gets liquidated.
All of these people are appointed by this, or they're part of this thing called the Monetary Policy Committee. Every month they get together and they pontificate about whether interest rates should stay level or go up. Though they may not actually have much choice, might they, if all these prices start going up, don't they have to raise interest rates?
Well, that's a debatable point because if you're just going to use interest rates to control inflation, this inflation hasn't been caused by too much money in circulation. No. It's been caused by a supply shock. And raising interest rates can only work if you're trying to stop inflationary expectations from being embedded in the population. So there is a case for raising them, but the problem with raising them, and the obvious problem, is ultimately you crash the economy. So you get rid of the inflation, but you've destroyed the economy.
Maybe they might decide they want to lower interest rates.
Well, that's the point. If you've crashed the economy, then you can bring the interest rates down, but then the economy doesn't necessarily just pick up again. This is the problem with monetary policy. And, of course, we're not allowed to use fiscal policy. The government's not allowed to intervene. The market's got to decide everything.
Oh, really? Well, let's see how long that lasts. Well, Steve Keen has been churning out quite a lot of material about this, The Economist, Martin. He's saying things like it's really, you know, you've got to the point now where it's really obvious you're going to have state intervention if you want to stop your economy going down the tank.
Well, I mean, we saw a bit of this during COVID. Whatever you think about what happened in COVID, the governments of the world had to basically take over. I mean, they were paying everybody's wages. We were all being paid.
Well, what stops governments intervening? Are they just afraid of the system that they might get things wrong?
Well, if you think about what happened after 2008 and after COVID, they just want to go back to what they've always done, which is ripping everybody off. That's what they want to do. And of course, in actual fact, that isn't a solution. And of course, it didn't matter in the past because there was no other alternative and there's nothing, if that's what they wanted to do, who can stop them? But of course, China and Russia have now developed an alternative model. And that, of course, means that you've got to compete with
model,
them and
funny,
you can't.
Funny thing is, they haven't developed anything. This is the model that Britain used to have before Thatcher.
Yeah, I mean, what they've done is the Chinese have copied what the Germans and the Americans did in the 19th century.
It's called industrial capitalism. It's called a mixed economy. It's the way it always used to work.
Well, I mean, at one stage, after the Second World War, the Americans allowed people to have a mixed economy because the alternative was that, in places like Italy and France, it was the communists coming to power and nationalizing everything. So they allowed them to have a mixed economy. But of course, once the Soviet Union had been dismantled, they then decided we're going back to 19th century policy of, you know, the serfs just do the work and we just take the profit.
Several bright sparks have been circulating this because they're looking at why on earth is the government not intervening more, telling the Americans to stop, etc. And that is largely because there is a sort of neutered system that we've got here. And one of your favourite people, Martin, is called Dominic Cummings. You remember him?
Oh, yes.
He had this to say about how the cabinet system really works and how democratic it actually is.
The person in the... So if you think of two roles, right? Foreign Secretary in Great Britain and the private secretary in the PM's office responsible for foreign affairs, an official whose name has never been in the newspapers. That person was like 10 times more powerful and important than the Secretary of State was. And I think this is something which people just don't really realize. And it's part of like how the whole system has just, has become fake. So you have fake meritocracy, fake responsibility, and then fake cabinet government. So they all walk up Downing Street, the cameras whir, they pose, they smile, ha ha, I'm going into the most powerful meeting, aren't I great? But it's all nonsense. The cabinet is just a kind of stage theatre. And actually, officials in the cabinet office have already decided it all. When you sit in Whitehall now, right, in meetings, they are literally scripted. So when the Prime Minister has a meeting with ministers, what happens is that before the Prime Minister has that meeting, officials go into the Prime Minister's study and they give him a folder. And in the folder at the front is a thing called Chairman's Notes. And that's the script. And that's what the Prime Minister reads out. And the conclusions of the meeting are in the Chairman's Notes drafted before the meeting happens, right? So the Prime Minister says, hello, Secretary of State, blah, blah, blah. And then all these officials sit around the sides on chairs around the edge of the room. And then the MP, the Secretary of State, all look down at their folders because they've all got their scripts, right? And this is why I use the MPC meme, right? Because then the Prime Minister reads out, well, we're here to discuss blah, blah, blah. And then he goes around the room and then Secretary of State for Justice or the Foreign Secretary reads out his bullet points. And then he reads out their bullet points and they read out. If anyone goes on script, you see the officials sort of go and then look over at the other official inside the room and kind of go, that means we'll come back to that after the meeting and make sure that that doesn't happen. And then at the end, fascinating, great discussion. Thank you so much for your wonderful, insightful, original contributions. And then he reads out the conclusions which are all drafted in advance. And it sounds like a parody, but it is literally how the British state functions. And the MPs are happy with that, right? Well, how does the psychology of it work? The officials are happy because they have almost all the real power. The cabinet secretary is now 100 times more powerful than any cabinet minister apart from the PM. And the MPs are happy because this whole system pretends that they're in charge. So both sides are basically happy with the fake version of the government.
The fake version of the government. It does sound a bit like a pantomime's going on in there, Martin. And actually, it's that these civil servants are managing much. And there is a sort of a network of, for example, the private secretary to the Prime Minister for Foreign Affairs is someone called Elisa Terry. No one's ever seen her or really knows anything about her at all. But she may be far more powerful than Yvette Cooper.
Well, as you know, Dominic Cummings was a sort of part of the Johnson government, but he didn't have a particular, you know, he was a sort of troubleshooter character. And people like him have always hated the civil servants. They've never liked them. And of course, the system does work because, I mean, basically China is run by civil servants.
I like what you're saying there, though. Yeah. I like what you're saying there because actually it doesn't look as if Yvette Cooper knows what she's doing. And even if she did, it doesn't look as if what she's saying has got any relevance to what's going on at all. She's just been reading out. She's one of those people that you can sort of wave your hand in front of her eye and she won't even notice. She's just reading stuff from a script. She doesn't really seem to have any ideas at all. So, for example, all the stuff to do with proscribing Palestine Action when she was Home Secretary, none of it made any sense. Before she was in government, she said she was going to proscribe the Order of Nine Angles, this fascist, Nazi, satanic organisation that organises assassinations and the terrorist group, but then when she comes to power she does absolutely nothing about it. So these individuals just seem to me to be they're literally puppets. They don't actually really have any decision making power. Someone's got to have that decision making power.
Yes, well, as I said, China is run by the civil service. There's no nonsense about people being elected and all the rest of it, and in actual fact it works. No, actually, Dominic Cummings doesn't like things run by the civil service.
It doesn't work, Martin. It doesn't work.
China works.
The idea, so why is it working?
They've got five-year plans,
if you're supporting this woman, Alisa Terry, you no one's ever heard of, it's not working, is it? Our foreign policy doesn't work?
Right. What we need is Robin Cook as foreign secretary, and he's got to boot out the US bases. But, of course, he's been killed, so he can't. When Liz Truss put through her ridiculous budget some years ago, the first thing they had to do was sack Sir Tom Scholar, who was the head of the Treasury. He was a senior civil service in the Treasury. So they got rid of him because he would have said what he was saying to them, this won't work. So they got rid of him and they did what they wanted anyway and crashed the car. But in actual fact, if Tom Scholar, name useful because he's a scholar, if he tells you not to do it, it's probably because it can't be done.
What if many of these civil servants are approved of by people like the City of London and royalty? That doesn't really... It's not a democratic system, is it?
No, it's not a democratic system. We need a proportional system with the civil services answerable to the executive and to the parliament. And, of course, we'll have to get rid of people like... Cummings just wants to be in charge. He wants to run it. No, who's voted for him? Nobody.
He's not saying that. He's just telling you. No, he's not. He's blowing the whistle, Martin.
He's not blowing the whistle, Tony.
Yes, he is.
He's got an axe to grind.
What he says, well, fine. Everyone has. You have.
Yes, and I've got my axe to grind. I want to chop off Dominic Cummings' head. I'm not really... Dear. Him going on about how the civil service don't know their job, really... Do you want Dominic in charge?
I'm not saying that.
Well,
no, but
that's what he wants. Well,
okay, maybe. But what I'm saying is that the idea is that the ministers, the elected people, should be in charge.
That's the theory. But anybody...
Maybe when they're weakened, the idea is that the civil service and other people can get away with doing what they
want. Listen, if I invite a plumber to come round to my house and do the plumbing for me... Right?
You don't want, I'm in charge. You don't want Yvette Cooper.
I am paying for it, okay? So I'm in charge, but I don't try and tell the plumber what to do because I don't know. That's why I pay the plumber for.
Well, is Yvette Cooper in charge? I don't think she is.
Well, not really. No. I mean, Keir Starmer isn't really in charge.
Who is?
The American Secret Services and MI6. And the Israelis.
The Israelis seem to be the Pax Judaica. Anyway, just to round off our look at the economic side of all of this that's going on, one of the major problems is quite a lot of ports are running out of this diesel for the ships anyway. So even if the Straits of Hormuz was open, they might not be able to get anything through it.
What's actually quite distinctive about this, certainly compared to things like the oil shocks of the 70s and the early 80s, is they weren't physical. They affected us as supply of oil shocks, but they weren't physical reductions in the supply of oil. It was more of a sort of extortion. You know, we're going to raise the price, and do you actually want to pay this higher price? What is very significant about what's happened in the last few weeks is this is a physical shortage that's occurring. There's an actual reduction in the amount of oil going through a crucial artery of the global economy. And you can't get oil no matter how hard you try if you're reliant on that supply. And for example, you know, the fuel oil that all these container ships around the world rely on, you know, there are major ports that are now in danger of running out of that fuel oil. So it's not just that they're going to have to pay more, they may just run out. So I think that's what has people spooked and makes some of the consequences for particular sectors a bit harder to predict, a bit more feels a bit like COVID, although obviously a fraction of the consequences of COVID.
Stephanie, thanks for that. Stephanie Flanders from Bloomberg. FTSE was down to 2.4% today. It's been drifting down since the beginning of the war.
Yeah, so FTSE down 2% a day. This is going dunk, 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 dunk. And there's no sign of this ending, is there?
No. And it's very, very worrying. If you're not scared of the future, you're not really paying attention.
So Mondays, do we have to watch out to see if there's going to be? The stock market crashes. That's when they traditionally take place, isn't it?
Well, Thursdays.
Is it?
Yeah, Black Thursday. Well, in any case, the point is that it doesn't matter which day it happens. If this carries on in the way it is now, the world economy will be crashed. There's no doubt about it. It's not might happen. It definitely will happen. And of course, there is no end to it because even if Trump and the Israelis wanted to stop now, the Iranians have got their tails up. You know, we're not stopping.
Well, hang on, because that's not... I mean, let's examine what happened with the gas fields this week. The Israelis attacked, the Iranians retaliated, and now there's been a sort of unofficial ceasefire, no more gas attacks. So although the Israelis are doing everything they can to escalate the tensions. Everyone is realizing that this is actually just the Israelis want this war to get bigger and bigger. So it makes sense for us to kind of limit what they're up to.
Well, yes.
Or limit our response to it.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, if the Americans have got enough leverage over the Israelis to stop them doing this stuff, well, that would be good.
So if you were evil Netanyahu, what would you be doing to escalate things?
Well, the obvious thing you can do is carry out false flag attacks on Gulf.
Where?
Gulf, you know, you draw these people in, like they've been trying to attack Turkey and Azerbaijan and blame the Iranians for it, and the Iranians saying that wasn't us.
Well, that's, so they failed to do that. Yeah, there's also, haven't there been arrests of Mossad officers trying to...
Obviously, they've got a big internal security problem. They've got to make sure that people inside Iran are not traitors.
So the Israeli agents are around trying to blow things up in order to escalate the conflict.
Well, that's right. So that's obviously, but the Iranians are wise to this because they've been, you know, they've been under sanctions since 1979.
And the Gulf states,
you know,
as well. I mean, it seems extraordinary to me that they're still sort of going along with the Americans and the Israelis, whereas actually it would make far more sense for them to just say to the Americans quietly, look, do you think you can just leave?
Well, that's what the Iranians want them to do.
Is that possible? Do you think it's not?
I think it is. So, I mean, don't forget, all of these Gulf states are incredibly vulnerable. They're basically candy castles built on sand. And if there's no oil and no water, there's no purpose for anybody to live there.
Well,
a few camels,
you could say
dates.
The same about Britain.
Well,
Britain could say to the Americans, please, can you just leave Fairford? We don't really want you here anymore.
Yes. In other words, as we go deeper into World War III, it's going to be a national liberation struggle for us, as it is for the Palestinians and it was for the Irish for 800 years.
Is it actually feasible that there might come to some sort of confrontation between Britain and the United States? I mean, actually troops on the ground saying to the American soldiers, stop doing that.
Well, as I said earlier, you can do things short of that by just cutting off things like water supply. Yeah, if they've got no water, they'll have to go, and they don't have to shoot anybody.
Well, one place where these things are supposed to be sorted out is the United Nations. This week, there was another attempt to smear the Iranians again.
It was a closed-door meeting of the Security Council called by Bahrain, one of the elected members of the council. It was an emergency meeting to deal with the situation in the Middle East. After the meeting concluded, the Bahraini ambassador told us this.
These dangerous developments are a result of cowardly attacks by Iran, which started on the February 28th. And continue to target member states of the Gulf Cooperation Council and Jordan and other brotherly countries. During the meeting, we and along with many council members stressed the need for compliance by Iran to its obligation under international law. And we called for the implementation of Resolution 2817, which demands that Iran immediately cease all attacks against our countries.
There's some talk about a potential new Security Council resolution on Iran's attacks on the Gulf countries, but it's unclear what might be in that resolution and when it might go to the Council for a vote. Gabriel Zondo, Al Jazeera at the United Nations in New York.
So that's a complete failure of the UN, really, to actually address the initial cause of the problem, Martin. Complete failure. And but I mean, you've got the Bahrainis. They seem to think that they're still on the side of the Israelis and the Americans, still trying to blame Iran.
Yes, and of course, the population in Bahrain is largely Shia, and they don't approve of what the government's doing at all. And therefore, I've seen videos of Shia people in Bahrain cheering as the missiles from Iran hit the US bases there. So, the UN Security Council, the people, you know, it's got permanent members and non-permanent members. But of course, there's loads of arm twisting goes on. Can you imagine if anybody voted against what the Americans wanted in the US Security Council? Some countries do. I mean, Yemen, for example, voted against the war in Iraq and they were put under sanctions straight away. I mean, Trump will tariff you just for nothing, you know. So that's how they're able to cajole people along, because they've got a big stick and they threaten to use it.
So do you think, let's have a look, think about developments over the next week or so. Do you think the US might lift some of these oil sanctions on the Iranians?
It's interesting, because the problems in the oil market, and people screaming in Trump's ear about the oil market, he's saying maybe we could let the Iranians sell their oil to keep the price down, but we can carry on bombing them. but it doesn't, it just doesn't, you know, it's just a series of contradictory wishes. The reality is that they control the rates of Straits of Hormuz, and I think they're playing a pretty good game here. We will let those who are nice to us have oil and gas. But if you're going to be nasty to us, the answer is no.
Will this Karg Island get invaded? As you said earlier, that there are US Marines being sent to the region.
I don't see how they can do it. I mean, it's physically getting them there. Don't forget the Straits of Hormuz are closed, so they can't bring the Marines in ships through the Straits of Hormuz. So they'll have to land them in Saudi Arabia, and then they'll have to take them in trucks across Saudi Arabia, probably to Qatar. And from there, they can't really invade an amphibious invasion. They'd have to go in helicopters. But the Iranians are just waiting for them. It'll be a turkey shoot. It's just a waste of time. They'll just get... Look what's happened in the Ukraine. How long do you think 2,500 Marines would last in the Ukraine? The answer is less than a week.
What about the nuclear threat? Let's just wind up with that.
Well, the obvious problem with all of this is that if the Israelis look as if they're losing, and they are losing, then the temptation is to nuke Iran, because it's sufficiently far away from them to delude themselves that it wouldn't directly affect them. Of course, that'll be really, really bad for the rest of us. Even if Iran is the only country destroyed and nobody else wants to get involved, that will be horrible.
See, this is the problem with what Mohamed Mirandi's saying, isn't it? He's saying, well, actually, we're winning a moral victory. Well, what's that if you've then got many or your major cities are flattened and your people killed?
Well, that's right. And of course, the Iranians who die in Tehran will be the lucky ones, because we in Britain will die slowly.
What do you mean?
Can you imagine what a nuclear attack on Iran does? It massively increases the air, the water, everything's polluted. The gas, all the gas and oil in the Gulf, you can forget about that. Nobody's going to touch that, are they? It'll all be radioactive. And that means that people in this country will die from various things.
Well, that's because we've managed to get ourselves into the position where, as you said before, we're so dependent on imports and exports, mostly importing trade. Mm-hmm. And we'll then have to rely on our farmers to survive. Are you a prepper, Martin? What are you thinking?
No, I don't think there's much point, to be honest with you.
Well, this is what Oliver's saying. It's actually food supplies here should be okay. This is bizarre that we're looking into facing this from this guy, Donald Trump, in the United States, who has actually gone along with some ridiculous idea to attack Iran, which hasn't been thought through at all and is completely unjustified and illegal. But that's the surreal world we live in, folks. Anyway, we're going to finish this evening with a excerpt from a documentary called The Old Gods Are Returning for Armageddon. Now, this came out in 2022, and to be quite frank with you, it is much better to watch, I would suggest, as a video, because it's got lots of illustrations of all these gods. But it's raising some really interesting questions, it seems to me, about maybe the forces that are in charge today have actually been around for thousands of years. It's like almost like a resurrection of these ancient gods.
The lessons given to our children in their classrooms, the breakdown of the family, the wokeism to cancel culture, children's cartoons, to every force and factor that has transformed the parameters of gender. Is it possible that behind all these things are ancient mysteries going back to the ancient Middle East?
Yes. What is the name in the Bible?
In the Bible, she's called Ashtoreth. She in Mesopotamia, she's called Ishtar. When she went into the Greek land, she was called Aphrodite and then Venus. She is all over. Hmm. And she's mentioned specifically there. Now, in the Canaanite mythology, she's actually the wife of Baal. So Baal has a wife. Okay. And so when Baal comes, the next one to come, it says in the Bible, says Baal, then it says Ashtoreth. Then she's coming in. So what this means is once the door is open, she is the goddess of sexuality, of sexual immorality. She's the goddess. She's actually called a prostitute. She's the goddess who her temples were filled with sexuality. All it was made it public. So if she returns, what would happen? If she comes back, it means that America is going to undergo a sexual revolution. That is the sign of the possession of Ishtar, or this goddess. And the thing is, so sex comes. What a prostitute is she actually damages marriage. She actually weakens marriage. That's what happens. Bring sexuality into the culture. In ancient times in Israel, she, in the Middle East, she put her images of naked people all over the culture. And so not only she was in her Greek form, she gave birth to a child named Eros. We get the word erotica. So erotica starts flooding America. She, the word for prostitute, which is what she was in her Greek incarnation, is the word porne. We get the word porn from it. So there's an explosion of pornography all over the culture. So what Baal does, in one sense, she's re-paganized. She's overturning biblical standards of sexuality and marriage, and she is paganizing our culture through sexuality and through possessing it. And she's also the goddess of spells and witchcraft. Hmm. So she casts her spell on America, and we are still in it to this day. It's irrational. It's not natural at all. Yeah. And it goes further, Sid, because something strange about the goddess, and that is, that has to do with gender. Because what she also did, let me tell you, in her ancient inscriptions, I'm looking at these ancient inscriptions, she says, I am a woman, I am a man. It says, this is, it's said in her hymns, it says, she has the power to transform a man into a woman and a woman into a man. So what's going to happen? What's going to happen if she comes into the culture? You're going to start seeing what she's going to do is she's going to start masculinizing women, defeminizing women, and feminizing men. That touches everything. I mean, touches our culture, touches the roles, touches radical feminism and sexuality. And so all this stuff that we're having, saying, how could this happen? This is all the goddess. This is all, it's all there.
How in the world did you figure all of this out?
Well, I don't take any credit for figuring it. It's just something. God shows me one thing, and then the next thing, I'm like, I'm the first one to be blown away by it. And Sidney even goes further. She had a priesthood. Her priests, listen to this, in her temples were men who dressed up as women. And they acted as women, dressed up. So what's going to happen if she comes back? What's going to happen is, as she possesses a culture, is that men will start dressing, we'll start seeing that in our culture, which we do. These are her ancient priesthood. Also, they were involved in same-sex sexuality. We see that explosion as well. Also, it says, remember, she says she turns men into women, transitions them, and women into men. Her priest, many of her priests were actually surgically altered. She caused them to be surgically altered.
I never knew that. Yes. I thought that was just something of our generation.
Well, we do it more sophisticated, but this is why I wrote this book. This is to reveal and arm believers and to know what's happening. And she especially, all the gods, but they go after the children. Because if you have the children, you have the future. And so that happened in ancient times, happening now. And so you think, what would possess an adult to do this to children? Well, what would possess it? The spirit. The spirit of the goddess. Hmm. And I'm going to go even farther because this is mind-boggling. And that is that the goddess was in charge, she was a goddess of parades. She had parades happening all over. And when I looked at the ancient inscriptions of the parades, it describes them, and it says in the parades, the men would dress up as women in the parades, the women would dress as men, it would be a parade of gender bending, and that's exactly what, when you see this happening now, that's the sign of the goddess. And, Sid, it's even like more mind-boggling because I'm looking at this, and I look at the ancient observers, and they said, when did this thing happen? They said it happened, even St. Jerome, it happened in the month, they called it in Latin, Junium. June was the month of the goddess. She claimed a month, June, and she was the goddess of pride. So we have now a pride month. It's all come back. This is not being, through these things, through these festivals, she possesses a culture. And that's the sign that she has come back.
Now, you say the gods are even influencing the rulings of the Supreme Court.
Yes.
And they've determined the exact timing of those rulings?
Yeah, this blew me away. Yes. Yeah. Since these things happened, there's been three landmark cases that have to do with gender and, you know, all these things, same sex and marriage. The first one was in 2003, had to do with legalizing. It happened in the ancient month of Tammuz. That's the lover of Ishtar. That's her month. It happened at the exact time, happened at the exact date of the goddess. The next one happened in 2013, struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. That happened same month, same exact day, month of the goddess, time of the summer solstice, all these pagan things. The last one, which struck down marriage, we all remember that. That happened month of the goddess, days of the goddess, same time, same date, June 26th. And Sid, remember when marriage was changed? Remember when that happened? We all remember it. That night, all over America, rainbows appear. And one of them appears on the White House. Remember that? That night on the ancient calendar, I looked this up in the Bible, was the night that is appointed, the 10th of Tammuz, appointed to cast a spell to cause a man to love a man on that day.
Yeah, kind of bizarre, but it's actually interesting to watch, I think, because many of these Sodom and Gomorrah style, you know, complete lack of morality, the idea that we could just tear up the rule book of morality, that no one actually thinks about this whole idea of sin anymore, that is most definitely taking place, isn't it? So that's documentary is called The Old Gods Are Returning for Armageddon 2022. Put a bit of version of that up on our show page, the full version, and a link to the full documentary. It's a rather unpolitically correct, but it's an excellent and an interesting way to look at things. We're trying to expand thinking here rather than reduce it and stop it, like so many seem to be doing over the years. The old gods may well be back, mightn't they? You know, human sacrifice. What's that all about? Well, that's what we've been seeing in Gaza, the sacrifice of humans, the sacrifice of children. You know, maybe it's not done in exact... Well, of course, it's not done exactly the same way with some massive statue of Baal where the children are sacrificed. It's done in a different way, but it's the same kind of principle. So this is obviously you know, whether you believe in God or not, this is not good karma, and it's not good going to get a good reaction from the universe, folks. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, also to our guests Oliver Tickell particularly and also Nigel Day from CND, plus others, and sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download this show as an MP3 from 11 to listen in the car, 11 p.m. that is, or anywhere you like. Do follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram if you want to get the app that's on pinned on there. Do please share interviews and story tips on my Tony Gosling Censored Telegram group and WhatsApp or my Facebook page. Download this show for length interviews, subscribe to the weekly newsletter, free it is, or you can donate and set up a small monthly sub. Thank you very much if you already do that. That's all on the show page this week, oneword.org.uk. This show's repeated 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on this stream, on the talkradio.org.uk stream, except for 5 p.m. Monday and Thursday, when you get the Richie Allen Show live, which is often well worth listening to. We're streaming live from Bristol, from the Cumber Centre, on the talkradio.org.uk aforementioned stream, at djplugradio.co.uk in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, holylandradio.com from roughly 11 till 2:30, depending on whether the time is, the winter time or not. Central time at 87.7 FM, West Sweden, Wisconsin, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is actually now the Bristol Politics Show app. If you can restream this show live or rebroadcast us, let me know and I'll credit you here. Have a relaxing, enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the week 4 of World War 3 Bristol Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless, and don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
On a brighter note, commercial break.
The government has now banned the carrying of spears.
Stop about every 1,000 miles, ain't asking too much, is it?
You might wish to stay on and listen.
It was a place where everything was legal.
I met this woman.
So if you're looking for emotional satisfaction, my advice to you is seek professional help.
Thank you for joining us live on the air.
My pleasure.
One nation under God has turned into one nation under the influence of one drug. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. On television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV, its satellite links are United States of unconsciousness. Apathetic, therapeutic, and extremely addictive. The methadone metronome, pumping out 150 channels 24 hours a day. You can flip through all of them, and still there's nothing worth watching. TV is the reason why less than 10% of our nation reads books daily. Why most people think Central America means Kansas. Socialism means un-American, and apartheid is a new headache remedy. Absorbed in its world, it's so hard to find us. It shapes our minds the most. Maybe the mother of our nation should remind us that we're sitting too close to the television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. TV is a stomping ground for political candidates, where bears in the woods are chased by Grecian fawns and bald eagles. TV is mechanized politics, remote control over the masses, co-sponsored by environmentally safe gases. Watch for the PBS special. It's a perpetuation of the two-party system, where image takes precedence over wisdom, where soundbite politics are served to the fast food culture, where straight teeth in your mouth are more important than the words that come out of it. Race baiting is the way to get selected. Will he Horton or will he not get elected on television? The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
On the screen is an address where you can mail your tithe offering or gift of love.
Okay, got the idea? All right, now let's concentrate.
Is it the reflector or the director? Does it imitate us or do we imitate it? Because a child watches 1,500 murders before he's 12 years old. And then we wonder why we've created a Jason generation that learns to laugh rather than abhor the whore. TV is a place where armchair generals and quarterbacks can experience firsthand the excitement of video warfare as the theme song is sung in the background. Sugar sweet sitcoms that leave us with a bad actor taste, while pop stars metamorphosize into soda pop stars. You saw the video, you heard the soundtrack. Well, now go buy the soft drink. Well, the only cola that I support would be a Union COLA cost of living allowance on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation. Back again, new and improved, we return to our irregularly programmed schedule, hidden cleverly between heavy-breasted beer and car commercials. CNN, ESPN, ABC, BCB, TNT, but mostly BS, where oxymoronic language like virtually spotless, fresh, frozen, light yet filling, and military intelligence have become standard. TV is a place where phrases are redefined, like recession to necessary downturn, crude oil on a beach to moose, civilian death to collateral damages, and being killed by your own army is now called friendly fire. TV is a place where the pursuit of happiness has become the pursuit of trivia, where toothpaste and cars have become sex objects, where imagination is sucked out of children by a cathode ray nipple. TV is the only wet nurse that would create a cripple. Television, the drug of a nation, breeding ignorance, feeding radiation on television. The drug of a nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation on television. The drug of the nation, breeding ignorance and feeding radiation.
Sell out right away.